Members, we'll call the meeting to order. We do not yet have a quorum. When we do, we'll take action on the minutes from March 1st. We also cannot move the bill just yet, Representative Scalzi, but please feel free to begin presenting the bill. Representative Scalzi is bringing forward House File 480, and as I mentioned, we'll take action on the motion for the bill when we have a quorum. Representative Scalzi, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for hearing my bill, House File 480. I really appreciate that you're taking the time. I know you have a busy schedule. This bill, House File 480, would amend the mandate that medical doctors transcribe their patient prescriptions electronically, whatever that means, whether fax or internet, by January 1st of 2011. That's this past January. No more paper prescriptions. There's no penalty in the law, and many doctors are still writing prescriptions. I've heard from many of them. My bill would exempt the doctors who operate in, My bill would exempt the doctors who have a clinic of two or fewer doctors, and it would lift the mandate on those doctors until 2016. And according to the Minnesota Medical Association, there are fewer than 100 of those types of doctors. So we're only talking about fewer than 100 of these doctors in the one to two doctor clinics in Minnesota out of a total of 16,000 doctors. So we're talking about fewer than 100 out of a total of 16,000. And there's many reasons why this might be troublesome for those small businesses on Main Street. It might be cost, lack of personnel, and I think you'll hear from Dr. Allen what some of those reasons are. These are precious small businesses on Main Street in our communities. And I have with me today a doctor who's the dream of many towns in Minnesota. He's a doctor with a practice on the Main Street in Little Canada. And I'll let him introduce himself and tell you his reasons why this bill would help a small clinic like his.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Scalzi. Doctor, welcome to the committee.
Thank
Please
you.
State your name for the record and then begin your
My name is James Allen, A-L-L-A-N, and I'm a doctor of medicine, and I practice in Little Canada, Minnesota. I don't know if I'm anybody's dream, but we'll see how I do here. In any event, I've been in practice for 39 years. I've been in practice for 26 years in Little Canada by myself. I own my own building. I own my own land. I currently take care of 3,000 people, about 400 families. That's kind of a little summary of what I do. I write prescriptions with paper. I'm not very good at one of these machines here, one of these keyboards. I think these are expensive. I think I would have to hire more people. It would be a burden to me and to the other 100 doctors or so who are small. There are monthly fees, training fees, software fees, all kinds of fees. And all I want to do is take care of sick people. And I've done it for 39 years by writing prescriptions. And I'm really interested in continuing to do that without incurring any further expense or delay. I generally see about 20 to 25 people a day. I'm not seeing any right now because I think this is important to keep doctors like myself out there in Minnesota. That's about it.
Dr. Allen, thank you for your testimony. My understanding, again, Representative Scalzi, this simply moves back the time. It gives more time for providers to get ready for this e-prescribing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. You're right. It has a moves back the date to 2016. I would say that, in my own opinion, I don't base this on any fact. I understand that some of your newer doctors are doing prescriptions on their iPhone. I think that there is a group of people that maybe will be willing to do that or in other methods, whatever electronic means. I guess it's not really spelled out. But I think my thought is these few doctors that have these small clinics that we're really trying to keep in our communities. And Little Canada is like a small town. Dr. Allen, everybody in Little Canada knows him. It's that kind of a deal that we've got going there, and it's good. Let me tell you, when you look at quality of life, that's a good thing.
Questions from members to either the author or the testifier. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed on the delay, I do support this. You know, I'm voting for this, and I do support it. And, Doctor, I want to thank you very much for doing a Main Street practice and the heart you have for your patients. Just really appreciate that. And we do want you to focus on taking care of people. But I would suspect also, though, just as I have a phone here that probably used to take a room full of computers to do, is now in this little thing. And I'm sure as some of the high volume and some of the others kind of go ahead of you and get some of these things worked out, that some of this may filter down and be a little cheaper, a little less easier for you, other creative innovations or ideas that may help you in regards to that. So I do support this, and I think at least a delay and maybe better, cheaper comes along, more effective, more useful. I know you're a progressive kind of person as well, but being one of the first innovators, that is not for the real small to be doing. Thank you for coming.
Members, we have two testifiers signed up to testify against the bill, and I would ask them to come forward. Now we have Dr. James Golden from, he's the Director of Health Policy Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. Dr. Golden, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the Director of the Division of Health Policy and State HIT Coordinator for the state of Minnesota. We do have concerns and are opposed to this bill on a couple of reasons, and I think the primary concern relates to the history associated with where this requirement came from. In 2006, the Institute of Medicine was looking at medication errors. And in 2006, the Institute of Medicine recommended that by 2010, all prescribers and pharmacies should start using e-prescriptions. And they said, quote, to become high reliability organizations preoccupied with improving medication safety. To do this, they will need to take advantage of the latest information technology and most up-to-date organizational and management strategies. And so in 2006, the Institute of Medicine recommended that by 2010, all prescribers go to e-prescribing. In Minnesota, we passed this law in 2008 and provided the prescribers three years to get up to speed with this. A couple of issues related to the cost of the technology for this. There are really two different ways of doing e-prescribing. One way to do it would be as a standalone system. Those systems right now are being offered in the marketplace for anywhere from free from organizations such as Allscripts to a cost of around $2,000. A second way to do that would be through an electronic health record. It has also been the position of the legislature that by 2015, all physician clinics and hospitals would need to have an interoperable electronic health record. And one of the requirements for an interoperable electronic health record is that it do e-prescribing today. While that's a much more expensive solution, it still would be possible for smaller clinics to use standalone systems in order to comply with the law. I think the other major issue around this is actually patient safety and the impact on the patients. The Institute of Medicine found that nationally there are 1.5 million preventable medication errors that occur each year. Simply moving to e-prescribing in an ambulatory setting would eliminate 1.9 million adverse events between 2008 and 2017. The Institute of Medicine also estimated that this would save the healthcare system nationally $29 billion, and they estimated that 70% of the savings and the safety would come from the prescribers actual participating in e-prescribing. And so I think those are our major concerns with that. The other thing that I would just say, Mr. Chair, as a technical note, is that this bill actually conflicts with a requirement that's in 62J495 on the interoperable electronic health records by 2015.
Dr. Golden, let me ask you this. We've just heard testimony that there's about 100 small clinics this would impact. What is the downside to having 100 small clinics in the state who are typically right on the edge, taking a couple more years to get this figured out?
Mr. Chair, I think the concern would be simply for the patients. Again, I think the medical panels of the Institute of Medicine have found that these are tools and techniques that can help avoid medication errors. The use of medication history can help to find counterindicated prescriptions when you have interactions that might be a problem. Depending on how it's done, if it's done in an electronic health record, you'd be able to more easily identify allergic reactions and the like. So I think the real concern is with regard to the quality of care that the patients would be able to receive.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Golden, I would suspect that those statistics are based upon pretty large systems. And the one thing we're dealing with here, large systems that are hospitals with many, many frequent doses. But the situation we're talking about here is 100 small clinics with many times single providers. I was wondering if you have statistics that are actually dealing with not the great, big, huge global thing, but is dealing more with something closer to the apples to apples, which we're talking about here, very small. I mean, I think it's a very big difference to talk about these huge systems and their statistics as compared to these small entities.
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Golden.
Representative Kiffmeyer, no, the statistics that I was providing are actually for ambulatory settings. And because those are nationwide, you would expect that those would be from smaller settings. Minnesota is a little unusual in the amount of consolidation that we have. The IOM had separate estimates for some of the hospital information that was there. And again, I certainly understand that there is a challenge associated with the clinics, that there is some work of thinking about how to integrate this into your care delivery. And there are some of the concerns with typing and the like. But again, this was a recommendation of IOM 10 years ago. And the technology that is there is quite robust right now because there is quite a national effort on trying to get more of the healthcare system electronified and using these types of tools to improve patient safety and patient care.
Let me ask you also, Dr. Golden, is there compelling evidence that small clinics like this, given another 2 years, would result in negative impacts? I know you've given us a lot of national statistics and best practices, but is there any evidence to suggest that by doing this we're going to cause grievous harm? Have there been reports of problems with prescribing from these clinics?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that there's any evidence that these types of clinics would have a higher or lower rate than what the national average would be.
Thank you. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, but then I also want to clarify. I heard you say that there's free technology out there for small clinics, and I remember nonprofits have had some issues with this as well. Did I hear that correctly?
Mr. Chair,
Dr. Golden,
Representative Norton, yes, that is correct. There are a variety of organizations that are right now offering many e-prescribing products for free. I think that some of the vendors are viewing this as a mechanism to introduce people to things such as electronic health records where they would have a longer-term interest.
Thank you. And the question.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, have other states moved forward with this type of technology and requirement? And if so, how successful are they, or are we leading the way on this one?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I think what is driving the technology today is the electronic health record. And one of the requirements around electronic health records at the national level is that they be certified. And as you might recall, when HITECH, which was part of the stimulus package, was passed that provided incentives for using electronic health records, one of the only requirements associated with a qualified health record in that bill actually was e-prescribing because the technology was sufficiently mature. And so from that perspective, I think most states are very active in thinking about how to do these types of technologies. They're just focusing a little bit more on the electronic health record. However, there are bills that are in, I believe, 11 states now that would require a variety of e-prescribing as a standalone item as well.
Representative Norton?
If I could just follow up, and perhaps this will be to Representative Scalzi when she comes back to the table, but I'm a little concerned, you know, if we do move ahead with this bill, and I'm not certain I'm there yet, but 2016 is a long way out for something that has technology on the we're right there. And I'm wondering if at some point later she could address why 2016 rather than just extending a year.
Representative Norton, perhaps you could have Representative Scalzi answer that question. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton. It was a number that appeared to me that if somebody had been in practice for 39 years, maybe wouldn't be in practice for another 39 years, but maybe 5 years. I mean, it would be great if he could.
You don't know.
You know, it would give a little bit of comfort before someone retires. And I think there's also another part of this that when you, and Dr. Allen can maybe elaborate a little bit more, when you prescribe a controlled substance, you still have to do those in writing. So there's, and I'm not sure what those reasons are, but we will never get away from the paper for the simple fact that your system could go down. A pharmacist is going to have to know what you want, so it's going to go in on paper, whether it's controlled or if your system is down. But maybe Dr. Allen has a few more comments about this.
Dr. Allen?
Yes, thank you. That's true. For example, if one of the audience came in to see me and had bronchitis, which is going around the community right now, and I prescribe them an antibiotic and a cough medicine, and let's say I had this business here, and I went on here and I said, where do you want your medicine? Well, I want it at Walgreens. You sure? Yes. Well, maybe CVS. Well, I don't know. Let's try Walgreens. So I do the antibiotic on the keyboard here, and then I have to take out my prescription pad to write the cough medicine. So you're writing anyway. I can write three times faster than I can do this. Whoops, what did I do there? See, that's what I mean. QED.
We're all good.
But I think, you know, after all this time, after I've written over 2 million prescriptions, and I'm not aware, I mean, I've probably made some errors, but I'm not aware that any graves were dug because of those 2 million. And I don't know that I have to leap into this for the next 5, 10 years, whatever it is. I think it's wonderful if we could have single and two-man practices just like when I was a kid instead of these large, large groups. So all I'm asking for is a little more time to continue to practice the way that I've done in our own community here.
Good. Representative Norton? Okay. We have Representative Franzen, and then, members, we have additional testifiers. Representative Franzen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Golden, what gives the state authority to tell doctors that they can't prescribe using paper and that they must move to an electronic method?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franzen, I think the authority is the legislature passed a requirement based on evidence that it would improve care within the state. in ways that we put other requirements on physicians and other types of practitioners.
Representative Franson.
Is there any studies done to see that this is actually working?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, there are actually quite a few studies that show that it does contribute quite significantly to patient safety and the identification of potentially adverse events.
Representative Franson. Very good. Members, any other questions for the testifiers before us? If not, we'll call up Twyla Brace is our next testifier. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Brace. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And as opposed to what you may have heard, I'm not opposed to the bill. I support the bill, but I would like it to go farther. And I'd like the mandate that everyone do electronic prescribing to be repealed. And I'm going to give you three reasons. One is that we look at this as a way where the patient has to decide, much like Dr. What was your last name?
Allen.
Dr. Allen. Much like Dr. Allen said, you know, he has to say, well, where are you getting it? Well, what if you decide to get it somewhere else later? So you have to tell them where you're going to get your meds, and then we believe that it can be tracked, and perhaps even the fact of whether you pick it up there can be tracked as well. As long as it's electronic, we're looking at information that is shareable because HIPAA doesn't protect medical privacy. And so we're looking at this as a privacy concern. Another reason, which Dr. Allen alluded to, is this is an unfunded mandate, and he also emphasized that by saying he has to do both the paper and the computer, and which is expensive as a practice. And then regarding the medical errors, I think it's really important to understand that the number of 45,000 to 98,000 has been inflated, and you can tell it just by the fact that we have so much less medical errors in this state than we should have if that many people were dying every day. And very importantly, a study showed that computerized physician order entry has caused 22 new medical errors. And so there are errors that are happening as a result of the electronic format. So we'd also just want to say that the HITECH Act does not mandate that everyone have electronic health records. And, of course, in this state, there is a mandate by 2015, and we believe that that should be undone so that individuals like Dr. Allen can practice without having to put their medical records of their patients all on the grid, as it were. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Any questions, members? The motion for this bill will be to lay over for possible inclusion in the health reform omnibus bill. I should ask if there's anybody else in the audience wanting to testify either for or against the bill. Anybody interested in testifying for or against the bill? Seeing none, members, last call for questions, discussion to the bill. Hearing none, I will move that House File 480 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Policy Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Hosh, I'm sorry. We have one. Oh, not after. Okay, very good. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, just out of curiosity, does it sound like this committee is going to maintain most policy aspects and have an omnibus bill, and the finance bill will be strictly based on the finances of health care?
Representative Hosh, that's correct. Yeah, we do anticipate having an omnibus policy reform bill. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. I'm going to turn the gavel over. Members, before we move to the next bill, we do have a quorum now, of course, and I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes from March 1st of 2011.
So moved.
Representative Huntley moves the minutes. He's reviewed them carefully. Any discussion, any changes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And the minutes are approved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gottwald, you have a bill that you'd like to move before the committee?
Madam Chair, it's always kind of interesting doing this, switching from one seat to the other quickly. Yes. Madam Chair, I would like to move that House File 200 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the committee, the Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Gottwald moves that House File 200 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, I also have a D1, the D12 amendment. Okay. And authors delete all amendment to offer.
Okay, members, you should have that in your packet. Would you like to explain the amendment, Representative Gottwald?
Madam Chair and members, this amendment really is something we worked out in cooperation with the Department of Health, the Minnesota Board on Aging, and the Alzheimer's Association that allows it, it makes it much simpler with regard to how we work with some of the research organizations the state contracts with in order to get the kind of information we're looking for, aggregate data that helps us do a better job in identifying best practices for treating Alzheimer's going forward. So it's really kind of a minor change. I'll walk through the DE amendment perhaps once we put it on.
Members, any questions or comments on the DE12 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, we are going to we'll walk through the bill briefly. It's not a long bill. This is really in response to a process we began last year with a bill to look into how we can start getting ready for the tsunami of Alzheimer's and dementia cases that Minnesota faces in the very near future. We as a state have done very little to prepare for the number of cases we are going to see, and there's an entire presentation we'll have here shortly from the people involved in this bill, the Alzheimer's Association, Board on Aging, and others. This is a reasonable beginning to this. The attempt here is to gather aggregate data to identify what is being done in the area of diagnosis and treatment for Alzheimer's to help us to begin identifying best practices, ways that we can most cost-effectively help deal with this disease, which is going to be, again, affecting many, many more Minnesotans in the very near future. It's not hyperbole to call it a tsunami. We face hundreds of thousands of cases here in Minnesota in the very near future with billions of dollars of impact to the state of Minnesota's economy. It is absolutely important that we get started in addressing this even as we face a deep budget deficit. Members, we've been working to try to make this as budget neutral as possible. I think we're very close to that. But in any case, we feel this is a very, very important measure to get us going. Again, we think it's a very reasonable and modest measure. We have data gathering going on. And again, this is aggregate data about what's already being done out there. We think we need to look at that carefully before we start talking about how to do things differently and better. There is language in Subdivision 2 that creates a learning collaborative. The commissioner is directed to develop that by July 1 of 2012. Comparison data also through the Minnesota Board on Aging, and then reporting back to the state legislature by January 15th of 2013, because we want to keep this moving. We want to hear what are the recommendations coming out of this analysis. What is the data telling us about what we need to do to get ready to take care of Alzheimer's? With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to invite up our testifiers.
Okay, if you could state your name for the record and then go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Norton has a question or comment.
I just have a comment, and I'm a co-author on this bill, so I'm very interested in the changes that have been made and what comes forward. But I do want to say one of the things that the state does do and this legislature does is invest on the other end of this particular issue, which is the state has invested in the Genomics Partnership, and one of the areas that the Genomics Partnership has spent some of its resources is studying Alzheimer's. So I just want to remind the group that we do need to prepare for what's ahead, but we can prepare for it in multiple ways. One way is a study. The other way is through continued research at institutions like Mayo Clinic and others. That just happens to be the one in my neck of the woods, but I just wanted to lay that out there before you get going.
Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
My name is Kathleen Harrington, and I'm here as chair of the Minnesota Board on Aging, and I was a member of the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group. This afternoon, I have two functions. One, I will describe the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group, its members, and the 18-month process that led to the report and the legislation we focus on today. Two, I also want to convey to you the strong support of the Minnesota Board on Aging for the report and its recommendations. I must commend you for the passage of the statute that did enact the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group. Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, your vision in introducing the legislation to bring together citizen experts to focus on this significant issue for our state cannot be underestimated or underappreciated. Minnesotans, for years to come, will be very grateful to you and your colleagues for your vision and commitment to finding real solutions in real time. In 2009, consistent with its mission, the Board on Aging convened and supported the working group. 20 experts members were appointed through an open appointment process. The working group elected Mr. Chuck Denny as chair. Mr. Denny, as many of you know, brought his considerable executive expertise, community engagement knowledge, passionate commitment, as well as his personal experience as a spousal caregiver to his leadership responsibility. Chuck ushered the 18-month process, which was intense, focused, involved over 90 citizens, 40-plus meetings, and was single-mindedly committed to realizing the vision of making Minnesota the first state in the nation to be prepared for, as Representative Gottwald said, the tsunami of Alzheimer's disease. As I said, over 90 citizens invested scores of hours and in the true spirit of public-private partnership created the report, which we commend to your special attention and reading. The working groups included the best minds in research in our state, treatment, long-term home and community-based caregiving, community advocates, our state departments of health and human services, the Federal Veterans Administration, and the Hennepin County Medical Centers. The working group analyzed the impact of this disease from a holistic perspective, challenges for families and caregivers, financial stressors, research and prognosis for a cure, and the economic stress on governments. Just as importantly, the working group explored the journey of people with Alzheimer's from the articulate and compelling contributions of the loving caregivers who participated. And most especially, we benefited greatly from the incredible participation of people with the disease. We all benefited from their generosity and willingness to let us walk in their shoes. And I cannot stress to you enough that the expertise in that working group was fully aware of the obligations we had in the discussions of the policy implications of making sure any kind of policy conversations were about deaggregated, de-identified data and HIPAA compliance. The working group was also able to leverage some new and exciting national activities, including the analysis done by the University of Wisconsin, calculating the financial impact of delayed placement into nursing homes on families, employers, state and federal governments, the national projection of costs attributable to Alzheimer's disease, early implementation of the state healthcare home model and other healthcare reform initiatives, and the inclusion of the cognition testing in the annual Medicare wellness visit. The final report is unique in its comprehensiveness, depth, and level of expert citizen participation. If you have not already had the opportunity to read the report, I'm confident you will find it illuminating and compelling. I am very grateful to the 90-plus individuals who gave so much of their time to make a difference for our state, and I thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I urge swift consideration and passage of this important legislation, and I pass the microphone now to Mary Burchard, my colleague and leader of the Alzheimer's Association, and who served as an appointed member of the working group. Mary will highlight some of the recommendations outlined in the final report.
Thank you, Kathleen, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It is my honor to overview the report for you today. The report spotlights the urgent need to address this impending crisis. Today, nearly 100,000 Minnesotans have Alzheimer's disease, and that number is expected to increase to 200,000 by 2050. The cost of doing nothing to address this coming Alzheimer's crisis will approach $20 billion annually in Minnesota by 2050. The report recommends actions that transform our medical and long-term care systems as well as our communities if we do several things. That is, the disease is diagnosed early, medical care is well managed, our providers meet standards for dementia care, nursing home placement is delayed through strong support of family caregivers, and patients and their families have a plan for treatment as well as palliative and end-of-life care. The significant costs of Alzheimer's disease are something I want to highlight to you today. There are 200,000 Minnesotans caring for those with Alzheimer's disease, providing 223 million hours of care annually. This represents a cost of $2.5 billion in unpaid care today. People on average with Alzheimer's disease live for 8 to 20 years with the disease. By age 80, 4% of Americans will live in nursing homes. For those with Alzheimer's, 75% live in nursing homes by age 80. The average cost of medical care for those with Alzheimer's disease versus those without is 3 times greater for Medicare patients and 9 times greater for those on medical assistance programs. But the real cost, the cost that brings many of us together, is perhaps biggest and borne by the caregivers. The cost to caregivers is tremendous. It is financial, physical, and emotional. 1/3 report depression and loss of work productivity, and 40% rate the stress of caregiving as high or very high. Alzheimer's is the 6th leading cause of death in the United States. There are no survivors. I need to point that out. I'd love to have a survivor next to me here at the table. Each year, it kills more Americans than breast and prostate cancer combined. Alzheimer's is the only disease in the top 10 causes of death in the United States without a way to prevent it, cure it, or slow its progress. Research dollars for Alzheimer's disease has declined over the past 2 to 3 years. Scientists have recently moved their research focus to preventing the disease, trying to delay or delay its onset. We have not had a new drug for Alzheimer's disease for over 8 years. Because a single cure is not imminent, we must act now to prepare Minnesotans for a future with Alzheimer's disease. With these numbers as a backdrop, the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group set out on the following, some key recommendations for action. First, to identify Alzheimer's early, to communicate with medical providers about the importance of benefits of early detection, leading to the assessment of cognitive health for all patients over 65. Today, 50% of those with Alzheimer's disease receive a diagnosis, 50%. And of that 50%, only 50% of those receive any type of treatment plan. We must do better. The group also recommends using a healthcare home model for Alzheimer's care. We request that we design a curriculum within the healthcare home that connects patients and families to professional care management immediately upon diagnosis and supports the patient and their caregiver during the entire course of the disease. And for caregivers, they request that we achieve quality and competence in dementia care. Providing easy access to information about resources and caregiver education across all stages of the disease, including adoption of dementia care standards and systems of credentialing that build dementia competency across Minnesota. And also very important to the working group was preparing our communities and the public. The group asked that we create and disseminate a list of key elements that communities should have to support those with Alzheimer's and their caregivers. And we urge Minnesota communities to adopt these elements and create action kits to help communities assess their progress. We know that the stigma of Alzheimer's prevents our families and our communities from moving forward and creating safe and healthy options for those living with dementia. There is great denial and isolation with Alzheimer's disease. As the number of those impacts skyrocket and baby boomers are at greatest risk as we come into age 65, the field of Alzheimer's is growing rapidly. The report recommends that we do a better job of training medical providers in dementia care. By developing protocols and best practices and standards for care of persons with Alzheimer's and using these in training for physicians, nurses, and allied health professionals. We highlighted also the that we need to intensify research and surveillance activities and use the information from screenings to develop more accurate state prevalence data on cognitive impairment and dementia care treatment, including an increased study of diverse communities, often more greatly impacted. And finally, the report recommends that the state aggressively pursue cost-saving strategies. We ask that they analyze the outcomes and costs of caring for those with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias using current practice as a baseline to compare outcomes and costs. We believe that there are cost savings in early identification, greater caregiver support, and greater collaboration between medical systems and community programs. The bill before you today selects three low-cost initial actions recommended by the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group and essential to prepare Minnesota for Alzheimer's in 2020. House File Number 200 is the first step to prepare Minnesota for the broad devastation of Alzheimer's. We believe we can alter the course of this demonstration through the passage by collecting the rates and results of cognitive screening, Alzheimer's and other dementia diagnoses, and general information about prescribed care and treatment plans. This allows us to know who is at risk and who has the diagnosis, and just as importantly, understand the current and future costs of this disease. We need to know the playing field before boldly moving forward. We ask also that there about the development of a healthcare home learning collaborative curriculum that includes screening and education on best practices regarding the identification and management of dementia patients. We believe this is necessary because if a patient has Alzheimer's, it impacts all other healthcare issues that patient will encounter. If the healthcare home model is to be effective for Minnesotans, it must address Alzheimer's to successfully deliver quality care at a lower cost. House File Number 200 also includes reviewing existing and forthcoming literature to estimate differences in the outcomes and costs of current practices for dementia care. Again, we think early identification, supportive caregivers, and greater collaboration can lead to cost savings. With this data, the state will benefit from existing and emerging research that can put Minnesota on the cutting edge of real health and human services reform by enacting policies that maximize care and support programs and saves dollars at the family, government, and community levels. I want to acknowledge that there are many people impacted by Alzheimer's in the room today. We see many of their faces. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your tremendous leadership that created the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group and for your continued leadership on this important health cause. And thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you. We have one more testifier, but first we have a question or comment from Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, I'm not sure who can answer this question. Let's see. It says, the commissioner shall collect the following measurements for Minnesotans 65 years of age and older from physician clinics. Is this a voluntary program for those 65 and older?
I can speak to the Medicare benefit that we would have this.
Ms. Harrington.
I'm sorry?
I was just stating your Ms. Harrington.
Oh, thank you. The Medicare benefit that this would, it now is in health reform, Medicare now offers in its wellness exam a benefit to have cognition screening. The data that can be collected, yes, on a voluntary basis, could be then evaluated in the analytics. So it's a voluntary benefit.
Representative Franzen.
Okay, then, are there any individuals in the system right now that are not...
Oh, yes. I'm sorry?
Are there any individuals in the system right now that have not been given consent to have their data collected?
Ms. Harrington.
all data is collected from a physician in compliant, HIPAA-compliant basis. So patients, when given any kind of medical exam, sign a that kind of authorization. But any kind of data that would be collected as part of the recommendations here are de-identified, aggregated data, all of which is HIPAA-compliant.
Okay, and while I'm so sorry, Madam Chair, Ms. Harrington, and we can talk about HIPAA some other time. But when the testifiers say low cost, what exactly is low cost?
I'm sorry,
Representative Franson.
I'm so sorry, but low cost. What is low cost?
Ms. Burchard.
Yes, we believe that that these actions will not require great expenditures of dollars to implement, and there are things in play already that these would be adapted or adopted in order for these to take place.
Okay, any other questions for these testifiers? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is very interesting, and it certainly is an issue that we should be addressing. In fact, my concern is that it probably doesn't go far enough. It seems to be just collecting data so far, and I would love to see policy, the legislation that really enacts some policies around how we serve these communities and how we assist families and communities as they go through the struggles of having a loved one who has Alzheimer's. So I think the report is great, and with the fastest growing population over 85, it's certainly we're going to have to do these kinds of figure out how we serve these kinds of populations. And so I just, my only concern, just not far enough, not yet enough. I'd like to see more.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have one more testifier. Twyla Brace, if you want to come and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Oh, yes, Madam Chair, and I have a handout for if there's someone to pick it up.
Okay, well, that's being passed out if you want to proceed.
Thank you. My name is Twyla Braze, again, President of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And while we understand the concern about the growth of Alzheimer's in this country, what we would say to you is that that is not reason enough that the state should have access to the information without the individual's consent. Now, the thing that I am passing out to you will show some of the data collection systems already by the Department of Health. If you look on one side, you'll see them, and most of them don't have consent. And I have heard that for this bill, they intend it to be aggregated, de-identified information. But it is still a health surveillance system meant to take data from individuals' medical records without their consent and to be used for purposes which those individuals may not appreciate. It could be used to push policies. It could be used to tell their doctors that their doctors are not providing the kind of care that the state government thinks the doctors should be provided for. It could be used for payment reform with financial penalties for those who do not comply with the way the government would like them to comply, who do not have follow the, quote, best practices or the protocols that the state has decided is the way to treat Alzheimer's, which could be rationing of health care. We don't know what the state's going to come up with for these elderly individuals. So individuals have a right not to have their data available for research purposes without their consent. And we often talk about privacy and say it's not as much about privacy as it is about control. So he who holds the data makes the rules. And those individuals who have their data taken from their medical records are not able to make rules about how it's used, not able to make rules about what happens to their doctor as a result of taking the data from their doctor's medical records. Now, if a doctor wants to ask the patient for consent, that's fine. And the patient wants to be part of a research study, that's fine. But it's really important to understand that HIPAA-compliant, as the former testifier talked about, does not mean there's any consent whatsoever. The word consent is not in HIPAA.
the word, if you look at your so-called notice of privacy practices at your doctor's office, you will find it is a notice of disclosure practices. And the paper that you signed is not anything having to do with consent, but that you know how broadly your information can be shared without your consent. So being HIPAA compliant should not be something that anybody is comforted by when it comes to data. And then the last thing I'll say is the best practices aspect. Just to say that that is the aim of the testimony, but as we said, the best practices measurement can actually turn into pay-for-performance compliance requirements for all the doctors who take care of these individuals. And so we would oppose this bill and stand up for the rights of individuals to not have their data used in ways they do not want their data used, collected, shared, or analyzed. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Any questions for the testifier? Excuse me, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Twyla, would you be willing to work with... Would you be willing to work with Representative Gottwald on that issue? I mean, would an amendment possibly correct that concern that you have? And Representative Gottwald, what are your thoughts about that?
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald, I guess two things. One is that a consent amendment would be a great thing because that would give the option of people to be involved in this. But as individuals who are looking at the budget and trying to figure out where you can cut costs, the continued advance of data systems on individuals is a concern of ours, and we would like the private sector to be moving forward and trying to get this kind of consent and do these kinds of projects, not the state government.
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, it's a very good question. I think we testified earlier. This is aggregated data. No individual's information is given in any way that identifies them individually. The testimony about consent, and we would be glad to meet with Ms. Brace or anybody else who has concerns about privacy. This is the first time I've heard Ms. Brace's concerns directly, but we would be more than happy to work with people if there's some comfort language we can put in here. I think the goal is very clear, members. We're trying to get information that helps us in aggregate identify best practices, training approaches, things that can help us get ready for this. Without that data, it's very difficult for us to prepare to address the tsunami of Alzheimer's cases coming. There is no intent here on the part of the state or the Board on Aging or the Alzheimer's Association to take people's private data to use for any other purpose. And again, if there's some comfort language we can work on together, I'm more than happy to do that because that is clearly not our intent here.
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you for that, Representative Gottwald. But the only thing that I would say is once the data has been taken and someone else can decide to use it in ways even you may not decide it should be used, and that's why we believe data is private property. It's not government property. And so individuals should have the right to determine whether their data can be used and have the right to ask exactly how it's going to be used and not let it be used for pay-for-performance, which is where this state is moving, or pay for compliance, which would be a better term for it.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really not for Ms. Braze, but just questions for the author, kind of on a different topic, actually. Representative Gottwald, first of all, you mentioned something about the cost being minimal, and I'm just wondering if there's a fiscal note or if you're expecting to have a fiscal note. I mean, as I look at this, it doesn't look like the cost would be zero. I mean, originally you started out with an appropriation. So could you just give us an idea of are you going to send this bill to the Finance Committee or what's your plan here?
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, thank you for your question. Of course, this is the Policy Reform Committee, so we are speaking to the merits of the bill in that regard. I think I indicated in my testimony, just in the interest of full disclosure, that there may be some cost involved and that we're trying to minimize that. We fully intend to have a fiscal note when we move to the Finance Committee.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Gottwald. The other question I had, and I just want to say, I support this effort, and I thank you for doing this. I think it is very important. And actually, I happen to live next door to one of the foremost experts, I think, in the country on Alzheimer's who happened to be Ronald Reagan's physician years ago. So this is of particular interest to me. But I noticed that in your DE-1 amendment, you have this clause about the commissioner contracting with a private entity, and then some language about sole source contract and being exempt from the competitive procurement process. And I think that's an addition from the original bill. So I wonder if you could tell us what that is.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Liebling. I appreciate the question. This is one of the areas that we worked on with the Department of Health and the Board on Aging and others. There is already a process through which the state works with Minnesota Community Measurement to do some analysis for these exact purposes, to identify data for purposes of best practices, trends, and that sort of thing. The feeling was it was better to work with that existing contract and with that existing entity because it reduces costs and also works with what we're already doing in the area of data aggregation. So that was the reason for creating this section. That's what it directs specifically. It's focused on Minnesota Community Measurement rather than creating a whole nother contract and a whole new set of analysis that would go on. And maybe the state could speak to that more directly, but I think that kind of sums up what we're trying to do in that section. That does reduce the cost. Again, we don't know exactly the dollar amount yet, but we will know that before we get to finance.
Thank you. That's
thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Question for Representative Gottwald. Perhaps you mentioned this, but one of the challenges on this side of the table is we try to hear, write our questions, and read the bill at the same time. Enough with the hyperbole, but you might have mentioned it. In this collective aggregate data, that are there names associated with the aggregate data that you're collecting on the Alzheimer's patients?
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, thank you for the question. Aggregate data by its very nature does not identify specific people. I mean, we're not looking for names. We're not looking for all of that information. We're looking for trends. We're looking for best practices. We're looking for what works and what doesn't work so that we can be very effective in trying to deal with this disease. And again, as I stated earlier, if there are people, Ms. Braze and others, who want to see some comfort language around that, more than willing to talk about that. Because, again, that is not our intent. Our intent is not to use this data for anything other than helping us get ready for the tsunami of Alzheimer.
Ms. Brace, briefly, we have one more question and have to move on.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's really important to say that the Community Measurements Project gets the data from the data warehouse in the state of Maine, where our data is sent without our consent, and where the health department has already testified to the fact that they can track everything that happens to an individual, whether or not they have their name, that the name is encrypted so they can't, but they can track every encounter that an individual has. And you perhaps do recall that in the testimony already today, the woman that was sitting over here said, this allows us to know who's at risk. Even though she may have meant some sort of aggregation like somebody in a clinic, the fact of the matter is we are talking about the ability to track individuals whether or not they had their name. But again, for us, it's really about what's going to happen with this data and how it's going to be used likely against the patient in time to come.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a chair, or this is a question for Representative Gottwald. I'm just looking at the language in the bill in subdivision 2, talking about the learning collaborative. And I had to go back to the statute and refresh my memory about the healthcare home learning collaborative. And as that law was passed, I think that collaborative is about the people who participate in a healthcare home together, talking about best practices for the healthcare home. I think it's important that we think about you know, a primary care provider and the arrangement of other providers responsible for the care for populations with conditions such as this. I support that and think that's smart, but I'm a little worried that the way this is constructed, the education directed to the healthcare home learning collaborative won't have very far reach, so you won't be reaching a lot of providers. And you might not be reaching healthcare homes that are very interested in the issue. So I haven't come up with a solution, but hoping that you'd be open to an idea where we might be able to reach more providers, if that's the goal, is to get more information to providers.
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, by all means, I'd be glad to talk with you about that. I think the intent is to begin here with identifying the best practice and then disseminate it. So these are first steps on a journey, and it's vitally important, and I'll maybe wrap up my presentation of the bill by stating we don't have a lot of time. We're already behind the eight ball. And Minnesota needs to get ready for, we've used the term tsunami, but it's really not out of line to call it that, of Alzheimer's and dementia cases coming. As Minnesotans age, as the baby boomers age, and as we age healthier longer, the incidence of Alzheimer's and dementia is going to grow exponentially. And so we really need these beginning steps, reasonable steps, to begin addressing that in a very constructive way. You see a number of people here today supporting this. You've seen the amount of collaboration we have around this. And I really hope members can support this as a reasonable first step. Again, data is not being used for other purposes. I understand the concern about it, the potential for that happening. I think that potential actually exists systemically, and I know that has been a concern of some of those who've testified against this bill. That is something that that perhaps we need to address additionally. But I am open to talking about comfort language in this bill, and Representative Murphy, I'd be open to talking about how we make this part stronger, too. Thank you, members.
Okay, with that, members, is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on behalf or with concerns to this bill? If you want to come to the table, please give your name for the record, and if you could give a brief testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Ephraim. I am a pediatrician, and I work with several policy organizations, but I am here as a citizen today. And I want to thank Representative Gottwalt for his intent and for his work on this bill, because it is a very serious issue, and I am testifying as someone who lost her grandfather to this disease and who just buried my mother-in-law in January. And there definitely needs to be more done. But you have to understand that the treatments that we have are wholly inadequate to the disease, the drugs. There is not enough research being done about nutritional and alternative therapies. There is not enough research being done on the potential causes, including research by Dr. Hugh Fudenberg, who found that a series of flu shots 5 years in a row is correlated, I'm not saying causal, but correlated to a huge increase in the risk of Alzheimer's disease or dementia. And the other thing that really needs to be done is the, and I will use the term whether you consider it hyperbolic or not, the holocaust of treatment for so-called treatment of using antipsychotics for the behavioral manifestations of Alzheimer's disease, even though they are not recommended for use by the FDA, and the black box warning and the increased death rates that are being caused by that, and the legal advice that I've given is that is both Medicaid and Medicare fraud, because it is being used off-label. So those are things that need to be discussed and looked at from both a policy and a research standpoint. And I do share Ms. Braze's concerns about the data collection and the data privacy aspects, and I do hope that an amendment requiring individual informed consent will be added. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ephraim. Representative Liebling, a question for the testifier?
No, Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to ask for a roll call on this vote.
Oh, a roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. And we have Mr. Renner.
Madam Chair and members, very briefly, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. Again, we are not opposed to this bill. Matter of fact, I think a lot of it, we support the direction it's going. But we had met with Representative Gottwalt, and with Subdivision 1, there's some language that we just wanted to let people know that we're trying to address also the issue of how we collect the data and how we make that most cost-effective, and how we use our community measurement, which is a group we support and have been very active in. So we've had some conversations. We couldn't get the language drafted in time. Representative Gottwald has indicated a willingness to work, and we just wanted to put that on the record that hopefully by the time we come to the Finance Committee, we'll have something worked out on that language. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Renner. And we have one more testifier interested in testifying. If you want to approach the table, introduce yourself for the record, and if you could give your testimony in about 2 minutes, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to talk on the subject. I apologize, I'm not particularly prepared, but I want to add to the record. My name is Don Lee. I live out in Eagan. I want to add a brief story that illustrates where we're going with this legislation, whether we think so or not. My mother recently fell into this Alzheimer's trap, and she's currently in an assisted living facility, and I ended up having a conversation with the doctor, with her and her husband in the room, and I came to the realization after having a little bit of argument with that doctor had absolutely no interest in what she wanted, what her husband wanted, or what I wanted. That doctor was not working for us because we were not paying the bill. That doctor was a manager, a bureaucrat, doing what the institution thought best, and we didn't matter. One of the broad questions being asked, being debated in our country right now is, who is responsible for and who is going to pay the bill for medical care? If this legislation and legislation of this type is passed, the collection of that data will inevitably and necessarily drive policy. And we are presupposing that the state is going to be paying bills for these Alzheimer's patients, which is probably quite true. But if that debate comes down on the side of we either don't want to go down that road or because the cost is too high, we cannot go down this road, then the withdrawal of that responsibility from individuals to collect this data, for private institutions to collect and do the best practice and so forth, and impose the one-size-fits-all attitude is going to be a bad policy choice, and that is my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, if I may, I agree with the concern just expressed. My only point would be I don't think this is taking us down the road of state-run Alzheimer's treatment. This is the state taking a leadership role in a critical public policy or public health issue, to identify best practices for everybody, private providers, people on public programs, all of the above. This is not meant to be the beginning of an oligopoly or a government-run approach.
Okay, members, any further questions or comments? Okay, with that, Representative Gottwald renews his motion that House File 200, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. There has been a roll call. A roll call has been requested, and the clerk will take the roll.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Mack.
Yes.
Abler. Barrett.
Yes.
Benson.
Yes.
Ranson.
No.
Britz.
Yes.
Grunhagen.
Yes.
Hosh.
Yes.
Huntley?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
Yes.
Liebling?
Yes.
Loeffler?
Yes.
Plomer?
No.
McDonald?
Yes.
McElpatrick?
Yes.
Moran?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Norton?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
Yes.
Abler.
Is this on passage?
Yes. Yes. Abler?
Yes.
Yep. There being 19 ayes and 2 nays, the motion prevails and the bill as amended is passed.
Thank you, members. Representative Kelly, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly moves that House File 447. I'm sorry, recommend. Representative Kelly doesn't make that motion. I do. I'll make the motion that House File 447 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on
Public Safety, I believe.
Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair, I also have a couple of amendments. The DE1 amendment.
Very good. Representative Kelly moves the DE1 amendment to House File 447. Representative Kelly, do you want to explain the DE1?
Mr. Chair, would you like me to explain that first or as part of the entire bill?
Let's move the DE1 amendment, and then we can speak to the bill in the form that you'd like to present it in. Members, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And Representative Kelly, it's now in the form that you'd like to have it presented in.
It's very close, Mr. Chair. I also have an A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative the DE1 amendment. Kelly, I'll move the A1 amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Very good. I think it's now in the form you wanted. And Representative Kelly, please proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Mr. Chair, members, House File 447 is the Vulnerable Adult Act. This is Minnesota's system for dealing with abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of people who are especially susceptible to harm. What I enjoy about presenting this bill to you is that this is definitely a collaborative effort. This has brought representatives from health and social services, law enforcement, other advocacy organizations, public agencies, and private organizations who are working across boundaries to prevent and respond to the victimization of vulnerable adults. I have Ms. Freeman with me, who I will let explain the changes to the Act, and then we will certainly stand for questions if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Iris Freeman. I'm Associate Director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy at William Mitchell Law School. My professional training, however, is in social work, and I've worked in vulnerable adult services and policy for 35 years now. I was 7 years old when I began. My job today, though, is briefly to describe the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project and highlight the health and human services content of House File 447. The Vulnerable Adult Justice Project is a collaboration, as Representative Kelly said, of associations, of agencies, and viewpoints all coming together to safeguard and advocate for vulnerable adults. And in your handout, there is a roster of the organizations that have come together to work on this and earlier legislation as well. One of the reasons we work as a group and one of the challenges we have in vulnerable adult casework is that effective work on these cases can be complicated by very different systems and different terminology. Law enforcement speaks with one set of acronyms, and the social workers speak with another set of acronyms, and other professionals have theirs, and people just talk like people, and sometimes it's hard to work at a consistent purpose. And that's why we are fortunate to have this group that, as Representative Kelly said, is working across agency boundaries to prevent and respond to victimization of vulnerable adults. That's the reform piece. Last week, some of you may have seen a recording of the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging, the hearing on elder abuse and the enormous need for resources in the field. This bill doesn't help us along the resource line. What it does do is try to make better use of the systems that we have now. That is what we can do in this day and age. And one of the critical parts of the DE1 amendment is that in the bill as originally introduced, on page 20, line 23,
24 to 26, there was a new duty for the Department of Human Services that was perceived as a cost item. That was removed in the DE1 amendment and makes this a policy bill completely. So let me highlight some of the facets of the bill as it's been amended. Ms. Aves' summary summarizes the bill as it was introduced. I'll do my best to refer to the sections in the new and the old. We'll see whether or not both eyes work. As I said, you have the summary, and I'll describe the key topics in the Health and Human Services area. Most reports of suspected abuse, neglect, or exploitation go to county hotlines. They're called common entry points. And depending upon the kind of case situation, the case might either be investigated by the health department or the human services department or the county. House File 447 in Section 16, and it's 16 in both the original and revised copies, clarifies the jurisdictions of the health and human services agencies using plainer terms, more contemporary terms, and terms for the services that are currently delivered. So the cases get routed accurately. Sometimes the most cost-effective thing you can do is get the case to the right place at the right time. And this also makes the responsibilities clearer to the general public. The House bill, Section 11 in the amended version, 12 originally, assures also that when the cases are being investigated, the vulnerable adult's guardian or health care agent will receive information that the person is at risk in accordance with their specific duties to protect or assist the vulnerable adult. It's not an outright information dissemination. It is just when their duties coincide with the issue that is being is under concern. Another issue studied by the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project over the last year was how to bring about effective working relationships between county adult protective services and tribal advocates for vulnerable adults on Indian lands. Under current law, counties can form multidisciplinary adult protective services teams to work on cases. In Section 15 of the bill, in both the original and amended versions, add to the list of groups that a county may choose to invite to be part of their multidisciplinary team, representatives of tribal governments. It's permissive. It is not a mandate. And similarly, on the other side, the invitation doesn't have to be accepted. Let me turn now to the issue of appeals. Minnesota law grants a range of appeals to people who are found to have mistreated a vulnerable adult, someone for whom there's been a finding of abuse or neglect. There's several things that they can do to say, hey, wait a minute, you got it wrong. When the vulnerable adult is, or their family is, unhappy with the resolution of the case, they have just one type of reconsideration under current law, and that is the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel. That exists in current law. So what we try to do to balance the scales a little bit is to strengthen the workings of the panel's operation to assure a thorough case examination when the vulnerable adult or their representative feels that the case wasn't really well fully investigated and that they're not being protected. This is in Section 3 of the amended Section 4 of the original. We also add a county representative to the team because 45% of all of these cases are investigated by the counties in these days. The bill also promises a vulnerable adult or his or her representative a detailed explanation if the review doesn't create any kind of change in the original finding. And we were helped in this regard by recommendations from the Department of Human Services and some of the clarifications of language in this part of the bill were made in the DE1 amendment. Next, we add information, protection, and a voice for vulnerable adults when a person who's been substantiated as a perpetrator appeals that finding. And we establish a means for the vulnerable adult, a guardian, or health care agent to submit information that will be considered in the appeal hearing. Sections 4 and 14 of the DE1 original bill, Sections 3, 5, and 13. This is also an opportunity for the agencies that made the finding to be encouraged to involve the vulnerable adult as a witness, but what it provides brand new for the very first are the opportunity for the person who was victimized in the case to submit something like a victim impact statement, so that is considered by the hearing officer. And also, just the notice that the case has been reopened is new. These are sections where the approach of the original bill was not the approach that the DHS hearing officers and administrative law judges would have liked best, and so we worked with them. They came up with some parts that we truly believe to be an improvement on ours, and we worked it out. All of that language is contained in both the DE1 and the A1, so I think all of those are satisfactory. Finally, the bill includes 8 or more terminology changes, not 8 different terms, 8 or more sections in which the term lead agency is clarified to be lead investigative agency, because in 1995, when this language was first enacted, there was only one lead agency, and now there are lots. Many of them have to do with reimbursement, so we wanted to clarify that. And so that is it in a nutshell. I think I covered each of the areas that were covered in the DE1 amendment. There's just one I see that I left out. Originally, when we drafted language to involve information for the healthcare agent and guardian when the vulnerable adult under their care is at risk, it was written broadly, and we received recommendations to narrow that down and make it very, very focused. So we did that, and with that, I will stand for questions if you would like to hear from your substantive witnesses first. You just tell me.
Mr. Chair, however you'd like to proceed, we can stand for questions now, or we do have 2 testifiers.
Members, why don't we open up to questions to Ms. Freeman? You have additional testifiers, though, as well, so we can either hold questions until after they're done, but if you'd like to ask a question of the current testifier. Yes, Representative Womer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to get a handle on the definition of a vulnerable adult, and it talks about a number in the section here, but I don't have that. Could you maybe explain that to me, please?
Yes, the definition of
Ms.
Womer. Mr. Chairman, Representative Womer. The section of law that defines all of the terms in this complex act is 626-5572. And a vulnerable adult under Minnesota law is anyone over the age of 18 who either receives certain kinds of services, such as a nursing home resident. They are by category people who may need a special degree of protection. And the second category is called the functional definition. And that is, regardless of whether or not they're receiving services in a hospital or a nursing home or an intermediate care facility for people with developmental disabilities, they are impaired to such a degree that not only are they having difficulty functioning in daily life, but they're also especially unable to call for help on their own. And so there are many states that have simple elder abuse laws. Anybody 65 or over is categorically vulnerable. But Minnesota takes the tack that there are 2 ways that we define people at a special need of care and protection by the community. One is by where they get services, and one is by their ability to function independently.
Representative Lober.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Then you mentioned about them filling out a report or something like that. Is there some way that you help people that fall into this category to do that? It might be difficult for them.
Ms. Freeman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lomer, most frequently reports about vulnerable adults come from folks in the community who are either mandated by state law because they're a nurse nursing vulnerable adults, or an interested neighbor. There's someone else who feels compelled, either by requirement of their profession or just concern of a neighbor who hears shrieks next door. They make the report. But I would say that there is a long distance that we need to go to increase public awareness of where to make the calls. There are agencies, organizations, social service organizations, ombudsmen for long-term care and for mental health and developmental disabilities that assist folks. And there are community organizations, one of whom you're going to hear from in a moment, that assists people. But getting the word out, just as it was in child abuse and domestic violence years ago, just making people recognize that there are systems to help is a big deal of work for us.
Representative Lohmer? Okay, very good. Any other questions? Seeing none, we have additional testifiers. Representative Kelly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just two, and we will be brief in respect of the committee's time.
Very good. Thank you. Candace Ballstead?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Candace Ballstead, a licensed social worker and the program coordinator for Faith in Action Central Goodhue County. And I'm here today to support the passage of House File 447, a bill to help vulnerable adults. In Goodhue County, as every other area, we have neighbors who are victims of abuse, neglect, and exploitation due to their advanced age or disabilities. Recently, 30-plus organizations that deal with vulnerable adults from Goodhue County began to focus their action on these issues by organizing the Elder Justice Network. The Elder Justice Network is a group of dedicated individuals, citizens, and professionals working together to educate the public, identify individuals at risk for abuse, and improve outcomes for those who suffer abuse. Our ultimate goal is to help the older adults in our communities stay safe and independent. It takes a combination of good state laws and community action to bring these kinds of tragic situations out of the shadows. In so many cases, for so many years, these cases have been family secrets that people are afraid to talk about. When we can provide caring, confidential, and coordinated help, we can make a big difference. Thank you, Representative Kelly, for your legislation to benefit the vulnerable adults and those of us who work to help them.
Very good. Thank you. Members, any questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Ballstead, for your testimony. And we have Carmen Castaneda. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carmen Castaneda, and I'm the program manager of Hennepin County Adult Protection Services. I've worked in Adult Protection Services for 23 years in overseeing that program that receives and investigates vulnerable adult maltreatment reports of abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of elderly and persons with disabilities. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, of which I've been a member since 2007. I'm not appearing as a representative of Hennepin County, although our agency certainly supports and is a member of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project. I'm here to testify in support of House File 447, which is a bill that seeks to strengthen the Vulnerable Adult Act and related laws to better improve public safety net for maltreated persons. We believe that the bill merits support for the following reasons. First of all, House File 447 will provide representation to county adult protection units by adding a social services representative from the county to the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel at the Department of Human Services. That panel now consists of the commissioners, representatives of the Commissioners of Health and Human Services, the Ombudsperson for Long-Term Care, and the Ombudsperson for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and a member of the Board of Aging. The inclusion of counties would lend a better balance to the panel in reviewing requests from vulnerable adults when they disagree with maltreatment decisions made on them by a lead investigative agency, which includes Adult Protection Services. As Ms. Freeman stated, 45% of all the reports that come to that are on maltreated vulnerable adults are handled by the counties. And a number of those reports that get to the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Committee involve self-neglect as a form of maltreatment. And it's only the counties that investigate self-neglect, so we would appreciate having a spot at the table for reviewing those appeals. Second, this bill also expands the rights of vulnerable adults to be notified when a substantiated perpetrator appeals a maltreatment finding involving a vulnerable adult. For example, as a result of an investigation that would be conducted by Adult Protection Services, a caregiver of an elderly person may have been determined to have forged that senior's checks or even to have taken money from their ATM by improper use of their PIN number. When we
in our investigation, give that caregiver perpetrator notice that they've been substantiated for financial disposition, if that's where the evidence comes out. That person who is the perpetrator also gets notice that they have appeal rights to contest that finding. Under current laws, the vulnerable adult or an interested person acting on behalf of that vulnerable adult, they're not parties to this hearing, and they don't have a chance to be present to tell their side of the story. House File 447 would permit involvement by the vulnerable adult to allow him or her to submit information that could be considered in the appeal hearing, and they also could serve as a witness in that hearing. Third, House File 447 also ensures that guardians and healthcare agents receive information about maltreatment of a vulnerable adult when their duties are relevant to the protection of that person. For example, if Adult Protection Services receives a report from a physician that an elderly person who suffers from dementia is having prescribed medications stolen from them or withheld from them by a caregiving relative, new language in House File 447 would allow us to notify the vulnerable adult's designated healthcare agent, who might be another family member. Early involvement by a healthcare agent can minimize further harm to that vulnerable adult and allow these substitute decision makers to do better jobs. And finally, the bill lends clarity to the jurisdictional duties of each of the three lead investigative agencies that receive and investigate maltreatment reports. Because the counties operate the common entry points, and this is the 24/7 telephone number that is the hotline that Ms. Freeman referred to, because we operate the common entry points, it would be helpful for us to have better clarification in the statute as to which agency receives which reports, because we triage those reports to the three lead investigative agencies of the Office of Health, the Department of Human Services Licensing, and to County Adult Protection Services. Examples of clarifications in the law that would be put into the statute would be, who does the investigations for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program? Who investigates hospice providers, home care providers, mental health clinics, chemical dependency programs? In summary, in this time of increasing vulnerable adult maltreatment reports and limited community resources, it's sound public policy for agencies to work collaboratively through the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project to pursue common goals that enhance protections for elderly and disabled persons who are victims of maltreatment. Therefore, we ask for your support of passage of House File 447. Thank you.
Grant, thank you, Ms. Constanita. Any questions to the testifier members? Okay, very good. Do we have any other people willing to testify for or against this bill? Testifiers for or against this bill? Very good. I think we have somebody who wants to testify. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Nicole Villavicencio, and I'm representing myself today as a citizen with a disability. And although I support this bill, the one thing that I would like to look further for you guys and would also like to work with you is to modify the definition of a vulnerable adult. And the reason that I felt so compelled to come up to you and testify just right off the cuff is because I actually had a threat done to myself that they were going to open a vulnerable adult case on myself. And as some of you have seen me around the Capitol and have talked to me, you know that I'm very outspoken and can advocate for myself very well. And so, like I said, the modification of the bill is what I would just advise to be changed.
Great. Ms. Vincenzio, thank you. Any questions to this testifier? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nicole, welcome. Glad to have you here. Sorry to hear about your incident, but the question I have is, you're mentioning modifying it. Could you let us know what it is that you want modified, if you kind of know?
Ms. Vincenzio.
Oh, sorry. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, as the last testifier said, that there's, under the definition of vulnerable adult, one of the requirements is that you're under services, health, you know, like nursing home services or that level of care services. Mm-hmm. And like, for instance, myself, I have county services and Social Security income. And so therefore, I am considered a vulnerable adult. So the modification that I would look at is that not everyone who is under county or state services would be considered a vulnerable adult.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there someone here from the department or anybody else or the author, Representative Kelly, that can address this that might clarify it or anything like that?
Anybody from the department? Members, we are going to work on this bill, and then I'll take advice from the committee as we go forward, but we do intend to hear the next bill and act on it yet this evening. We can do that a couple of different ways. We can either continue through 4:30, or we can break at 4:15 and come back at 4:45.
Mr. Chairman, and was it Representative Kiffmeyer who asked the question?
Ms. Freeman, yes.
Yes. Although the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project didn't work on definitions of a vulnerable adult this time, we tried to make them better in 2009, and that is something that we have to keep working on, because, in fact, the definition is simply intended to be who are the people about whom a report should be made, and yet it, to the extent that it feels like it's also taking away rights, we want to be sensitive to those things. So I can't speak for public agencies, but I can speak for the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, that those definitions should be brought into modern language, just like some of the parts of the bill that we worked on this year. And so there is plenty of work to be done on this and a lot of willing hands.
Mr. Kerber, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Director of the Licensing Division at the Department of Human Services. And we're one of the agencies, we're one of the lead agencies that does maltreatment investigations under the Vulnerable Adult Law. And if I understand the question, it relates to the definition of who is a categorical vulnerable adult. And I think if possible, I'd like to speak with a witness, maybe off the record here, and talk about that a little bit. Not everybody who receives services is categorically a vulnerable adult. Under law, it gets to be pretty clear that if you receive services from a licensed facility that's licensed by the Health Department or by the Department of Human Services, then you are categorically a vulnerable adult. And even among those, like, for instance, outpatient chemical dependency treatment programs, everybody who receives services from those programs aren't categorical vulnerable adults, nor are the people receiving services from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. There has to be an evaluation of those folks to determine whether or not they meet that functional definition of vulnerable adults. So it isn't quite as broad as anybody who's getting any kind of public assistance or involved in any program overseen by the Department of Human Services or Health. That doesn't make any of us a vulnerable adult categorically.
Great. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think with the conversation about having an ongoing discussion, that I think that will, I think that's where it belongs, and to kind of clarify. I didn't know if maybe there was some shorter answer sometimes that could be addressed now, but it appears as though it needs a little bit more. That's fine. We'll see you again. I'm sure we'll see this bill again. Thank you.
Very good. Any other testifiers for or against this bill? Any other testimony? Members, further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 447 is amended, be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is passed as amended.
Chair members.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Members, as I mentioned, we have a choice here. We can break at 4:15. Hopefully we don't go to 10:15. At 4:15, we can take a half-hour break and come back at 4:45, or we can simply continue with the next bill and leave when we're done with that bill.
Mr. Chair?
What's the will of the committee? Representative Moran. Continue?
I would say continue as well, Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
Yep. Is that the consensus? Okay. Representative Grinhagen. And Representative Grinhagen moves that House File 468 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grinhagen, welcome.
And members, House File 468, just to speak to the bill, it's pretty straightforward. State funds must not be expended in the planning and implementation of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Also, no provisions of the Act may be implemented until the constitutionality of the Act has been determined by the United States Supreme Court. With that, Mr. Chair, I would just speak to some of the concerns I have about the Act and why I'm bringing it forward.
Okay, and members, Representative Grinhagen and Representative Huntley have some handouts which are being shared right now for your information. Representative Grinhagen, please proceed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd just like to recognize there's strong opinions on both sides of this issue and a lot of passion, and I understand that people of goodwill can disagree on this legislation. However, I have come to believe that this legislation poses a serious threat to the healthcare industry in the state of Minnesota, and therefore I strongly oppose it and have brought forth this bill. Just a couple information about my concerns. I've handed out inside your jacket. I'd just like to quote for the record, IBD did a poll back in August of 2009 where 4 out of 9 doctors said that they would consider leaving their practice or taking early retirement if Congress passed what has become known as the Obamacare Act. That means, members, that over 360,000 physicians would leave the medical care treatment industry. Now, that poll received a lot of criticism. It had one other factor in it. The poll showed that 6 in 10 doctors agreed that the Affordable Care Act plan would strip drug companies of the incentives they need to make life-saving pharmaceuticals. And 65% of those doctors believe that the government overhaul would lead to lower quality care for seniors. In addition to that, there was another poll done just recently in August of 2010 where they surveyed about 2,400 doctors. And those results were basically the same. The majority of those doctors, 40%, they said they would retire, seek a non-clinical job in healthcare, or leave the healthcare industry completely if the Affordable Care Act was implemented. Finally, one other result, 8 out of 10 of those doctors surveyed under the Merritt-Hawkins survey believe that the viability of the private practice model would significantly restrict their practice to at least one of the categories of patient care. The other couple things I'd like to draw the committee's attention to is in an article dated February 14th, 2011, CBO Director Doug Elmendorf testified before Congress that the Affordable Care Act, again, this is a CBO director, will destroy 800,000 private sector jobs if implemented by the year 2021. In addition, Elmendorf claimed that number might be quite low, considering that it has been estimated that Obamacare will impose $500 billion in new taxes and will actually cost more than $2.3 trillion in the next 10 years. Now, we've heard testimony here already, members, that the reimbursement rate and the cost figures for the Affordable Care Act are based on Medicaid reimbursement rates. Well, we all know what those Medicaid rates are doing to our doctors and hospitals. They're underpaying them based on their cost. They're driving up our private healthcare premiums, both on group and individual. So this is a formula for destroying the private insurance market and ultimately moving everyone to a government-run system, in my opinion. Dr. Donald Berwick, he is the choice to head of the Obama administration to head the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He testified, oh, by the way, he's a admirer of the British national healthcare system, which has rationing and cost-effective standards. He testified during his testimony, a congressional member stated that Medicare actuaries predict that the because of the cuts in the Affordable Care Act health care law, 725 hospitals, 2,352 nursing homes, and 1,587 home health care agencies will become unprofitable. A representative from Texas stated that 300 doctors in his state have already dropped Medicare. Keep in mind that the Affordable Care Act calls for $575 billion in Medicare cuts. And I'll let you read the rest of the article that's in your packet. Members, this plan is going to be, in my opinion, an economic and health care disaster for not only ourselves, but our children, our grandchildren. We need to oppose this plan in every way possible. And, of course, I believe it's up to 26 states have already joined in the lawsuit against Obamacare. At this time, I would ask Attorney Kim Crockett to come forward and testify on the constitutionality of the plan. Kim?
Thank you, Representative Grinhagen. Ms. Crockett, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Hi, I'm Kim Crockett. I'm president of the Minnesota Free Market Institute. What's our timing?
We're good to go.
We're good to go. Okay. Well, thank you for inviting me to testify today. I've been writing about federalism and the Constitution as a leader in the Federalist Society for about 25 years, and more recently as president of the Minnesota Free Market Institute. And I will try to keep my comments brief because I think that there are people behind me as well. I'm going to briefly outline how House File 468 fits into the legal debate surrounding Obamacare. I'm not testifying for or against this legislation. I'm a C3.
Ms. Crockett, if you could speak a little more into the microphone.
I apologize.
We've got some
Minnesota
can't quite
poll.
Hear.
Is that better?
Thank you. That's very
Thank
good.
Thank you. I was going to say I'm going to just briefly outline how this bill fits into the legal debate surrounding Obamacare. And just in case we bump up against time, I want to quote from Judge Vinson's order that was issued last week in a stay on the Florida litigation that was just mentioned. And I quote, "I strongly believe that expanding the commerce power to permit Congress to regulate and mandate mental decisions not to purchase health insurance or any other product or service would emasculate much of the rest of the Constitution and effectively remove all limitations on the power of the federal government." I want to start with that to set the tone. House File 468 is a straightforward prohibition on the use of state funds for the implementation of Obamacare. If it became law, it would prohibit the use of state funds unless Obamacare is found constitutional by the Supreme Court. Like Governor Pawlenty, before he left office, governors in Alaska and Florida have prohibited the use of state funds for the implementation of Obamacare. Governor Dayton, excuse me, rescinded Pawlenty's order on January 5th, so the legislature may, or in my opinion, must act. House File 468 is consistent with the Freedom of Choice and Health Care Act, known as Senate File 33 or House File 199, which has already passed various committees here in Minnesota. It clearly asserts that the state has the authority to set health care policy and that the power to regulate health care is reserved unto the people and the state under the 9th and 10th Amendments of the United States Constitution. The vulnerability of both bills to a veto by the governor points to the need for a constitutional amendment in addition to legislation. And I provided in written testimony pros and cons of those two approaches to you, but won't go over them today. The bill before you is a legitimate assertion of state legislative authority. It's also a natural extension of the freedom of choice legislation also under consideration. The legal argument for the bill is as follows. If you agree with Judge Vinson's opinion in Florida, as I do, the individual mandate is not a constitutional exercise of congressional authority. The individual mandate, by the way, under the Obamacare federal legislation, is not a constitutional exercise of congressional authority either under the broad taxing power or the Commerce Clause. And I won't go into any detail unless you have questions about that today. Obamacare does not contain what's called a severability clause in the congressional legislation, and therefore he struck down the entire act, rather than just the individual mandate. State legislators, you and the governor, have sworn to uphold the United States Constitution and the Constitution of Minnesota. And to the extent that Obamacare, or you believe Obamacare, is unconstitutional, the state is duty-bound to use any lawful means necessary to stop the implementation of the act. House File 468 is a measured response to Obamacare. The state would be acting prudently to withhold funds from congressional legislation that has been found unconstitutional by a federal court, particularly in light of the unprecedented scope and nature of Obamacare. Obamacare does not just require significant state funds and resources for implementation, it imposes new costs on businesses and individuals. If the Supreme Court finds Obamacare unconstitutional, unwinding its implementation will be disruptive, confusing, and costly. Really, no matter what you do here today, but it will be. This bill is a responsible
approach. Ms. Crockett, if you could hold on just a sec. We do have a question from Representative Moran.
Sure.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. As a new legislator, I would really, as I'm learning this process, it would be really, really nice if you would use the proper term for what you are talking about, the Affordable Care Act. I need to hear that so I can make a valid decision around this legislation. So instead of using the word Obamacare, could you please use the Affordable Care Act?
Sure. I don't think a lot of people know what the Affordable Care
Act is. That's why I need to hear it.
It's the coinage of the realm. So yeah. I'd
actually,
be happy to do that.
Actually, members in this committee, we have discussed the fact that both are used quite a bit, both in the media and colloquially, and I think it's fair to use either term, frankly. So, Ms. Crockett, if you could continue.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to try to do that, and if I slip, I apologize. This bill is a responsible approach, Bill 468, because it anticipates a ruling from the Supreme Court before the Health Care Act has been fully implemented in the year 2014. Finally, the House File 486 would be null and void if the Federal Health Care Act is found to be constitutional. Now, just quickly, and again, I provided written testimony, which is available to the committee, on the Florida case. Last week, Judge Vinson stayed the injunction that he had issued at the end of January. And it happened right at the end of the week, and if you're all familiar with those details, I'm amazed because you deal with so much. But in essence, what he did at the end of January is he, and this is in the case where the 26 states have sued on the constitutionality, he said, I am issuing an injunction. The Department of Justice said, and the administration said, oh, well, we'll just go ahead and implement it while this works through the appeals process. And at the end of the week last week, he issued another order clarifying what he'd said in January, which was that I had issued an injunction. Yet he decided, for a variety of very complex legal reasons, to go ahead and stay his order. But he ordered the Department of Justice to file a notice of appeal by this Thursday, March 10th. And if they do not, the stay will be lifted. This speeds up, if you will, the appeals process for the Health Care Act. And it makes it more likely that we'll get to the Supreme Court sooner. And as I said, I provided fairly detailed information about that, and it's available, and I'm happy to provide more if the committee wants it. One of the things I want to point out from the judge's order last week that affects Minnesota is that he noted that one could argue, and I'll quote, one could argue that the entire point in front-loading certain of the Health Care Act's provisions in the first place could be that and why the executive branch continued to seek implementation was for the very reason that the implemented provisions would be hard to undo once they are fully in place. And I note that today because this House File 468 is about implementation of the federal act. On a practical side, and Judge Vinson actually talked about this in his order last week, you as a legislature may be tempted to hedge your bets and proceed with implementation until the Supreme Court rules. And given the severe fiscal challenges facing the state, you may wish to consider that the federal government's going to proceed no matter what the state of Minnesota does. You can still expend federal funds that you receive at the governor's invitation, but House File 468 would preserve state funds in a time of severe budgetary constraints, and it avoids committing state funds for the implementation of a new federal program that could be found unconstitutional before it's fully implemented in about 3 years, 2014. I would also note that, however, spending even federal funds given to the state of Minnesota undermines any legal position it might take that the act is unconstitutional. But right now, Minnesota is not a plaintiff in any of those lawsuits. So Minnesota can proceed with planning, for example, that's an interest in the room today, insurance exchanges, but it does not have to implement any federal health care policy in this session, the 2011 session. Another legal argument to be considered, and I won't go into great detail today, is that the implementation of any federal health care reform unconstitutionally commandeers the state insurance regulatory resources. And note that Florida's House Speaker Dean Cannon made that argument in a cease and desist letter to former Governor Crist. And the commandeering case, it's well known as New York versus United States, 1992. Again, I've provided other information to you in written materials, and note that the reaction around the states has been what I would call allergic to the Federal Health Care Act. 42 states have introduced, at least 42 states have introduced or announced legislation similar to the health, the Freedom of Choice Act here in Minnesota that passed Senate File 33. Two states have passed constitutional amendments, and 26 states joined Attorney General Bill McCollum in Florida. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. Questions, members, to the testifier? Representative Franson.
All these papers. Sorry. You're going to have to help me out. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And testifier, I'm so sorry I can't find my paper that has your name on it.
Kim Crockett.
Ms. Crockett, thank you. Okay, so when you mentioned the exchange, I see that there's an amendment today for an exchange attached for this bill. And there's also a sunset clause in there. And you also did you mentioned anything that is put in place is really hard to take back, correct?
Well, I was just noting that the implementation of the federal legislation, a lot of it's front-loaded, and Judge Vinson noted that last week in his opinion. It's just, no matter what you do, a lot of that steamrolling ahead.
Right.
It's just you have to decide how you're going to respond as a state.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Franson. Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I'm just wondering how it is that Medicare is constitutional.
It's viewed as authorized. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy. I'm getting used to this protocol.
It's okay.
It's considered constitutional under the broad taxing power of Congress. Whereas this is viewed as a penalty, was viewed as a civil regulatory penalty that is not. And actually, all the federal judges who ruled on this have found it to be a civil penalty, not something that's justified under the broad taxing power of Congress. So then it goes under a different legal analysis, and that is whether or not Congress had the authority to regulate in this particular area under the Commerce Clause. And right now, there's like a 3-2 split in the federal courts on whether or not Congress had that authority.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so to the testifier, can you talk to me about how the penalty is enforced?
Ms. Crockett.
I'm not that familiar with, I know that funds would be expended to do that, and I'm not fully qualified to talk about the ins and outs of the federal legislation. I know that IRS agents, many IRS agents are expected to be hired, and other federal agents in order to both enforce the penalty, but also just to gather the information on whether or not people have complied. And I see
Representative Grenhagen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the I had another testifier here, Dave Racer. He had to leave, who's done extensive research on the Affordable Care Act, and he was going to address that, but suffice it to say that within the bill is to implement the fine, an additional 16,000 IRS agents would be hired to work with that. I don't have all the details like Mr. Racer did, but unfortunately he had to leave.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And it just seems to me that if the IRS is involved in the penalty, that it's a tax penalty. And a tax penalty would make this tax policy. And thus, it seems to me that there is at least a plausible argument that it is constitutional, just as Medicare is constitutional. Thank you.
Representative Grenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just commenting on Kim's, Ms. Krupp, what do you prefer?
Kim's fine.
Okay. Have we met before?
Yes, we have.
Yeah. The
great place to meet.
Yeah, a great place to meet at this time. You know, the reference that Ms. Crockett referred to in terms of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act undermining the lawsuits is what's really a concern of mine and why I want to see a complete halt to the implementation of Obamacare or Affordable Care Act. Until the constitutionality has been determined. The indications are that the Supreme Court will rule on this sometime in the summer of 2012, is my understanding from some of the articles I've read, but obviously there's no guarantee on that.
Members, other questions? Seeing none, I know we have additional testifiers. Thank you, Ms. Crockett.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grenhagen.
As I mentioned, Mr. Dave Racer was going to testify. He studied the Affordable Care Act extensively, has written on health care several books and numerous dozens and dozens of articles. Unfortunately, he had to leave. He did ask me to make a couple comments from his testimony, if I might have permission to share that today.
Absolutely. Please.
Again, these are Mr. Racer's comments. He said, regulations have been incredibly hard to write and deadlines have been missed under the Affordable Care Act. More than 6,000 pages of regulations have been written, with as much as 100,000 additional regulations on the horizon. There's $5 billion in implementation has been funded for high-risk pools. Federal high-risk pools have attracted 12,500 people, not the 375,000 as the Affordable Care Act assumed, plus $6 billion to create exchanges and $5 billion for a reinsurance program. A total of $105 billion is already funded, subject to defunding. The conclusion is simply this. We are transferring billions and billions of dollars away from health care and the doctor-patient relationship into government bureaucracy. This is an illustration of the bureaucracy they wish to set up. The patient is over here, the doctor's over here. If you can get through the maze, you can see the doctor. And you have to get through this maze of requirements, mandates, and regulations administered by nameless, faceless government bureaucrats. Now, that's not to say I don't like nameless, faceless government bureaucrats. I just don't want them controlling my health care. I hope you can understand that. Okay. With that, I will end the testimony for Mr. Dave Racer, and I would ask my next testifier, Twyla Brace, to come forward.
Ms. Brace, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Twyla Brace, President of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I just want to underscore several of the pieces that Ms. Crockett mentioned, because she was talking about the ruling of Judge Vinson, and the only thing I want to add to the ruling of Judge Vinson, which she did not, she kind of alluded to, but more specifically, just so that you know, one of the reasons that he stayed his injunction, besides the fact that I think he wanted to use that as a way to get them to go quickly to the appeals court and to the or to the Supreme Court, is that he said that already states are implementing Obamacare, undercutting his ruling against Obamacare, and therefore him staying his ruling will help it to be less disruptive for states, which only goes to show that if a state continues to move towards Obamacare, it will be more difficult for the U.S. Supreme Court to also make a decision to throw the whole thing out, because it will be disruptive. And so for those who do not want to have Obamacare become law, it's really important that the state not move forward to implement any piece of it, to use the money, to access the money, et cetera. I want to mention, in addition to what Representative Grunhagen said, that it was at the National Governors Conference or Association meeting, I believe it was a year or a year and a half ago, that they actually thought that it would end up in 250,000 pages of regulations, not just 100. So it's even worse than you thought, Representative Grunhagen, if they were accurate. And it's a 2,700-page ruling and 250,000 pages of regs, which become like law, which means that most of the law isn't written by the representatives in Congress. It's written by those faceless, nameless bureaucrats. There's 159 brand new government agencies through Obamacare that would be funded, so everything that we can do to not be part of them ruling over our life would be great. And then to just remind you about the cost increases under Obamacare, the cost is expected to increase to individuals 10 to 13% according to the CBO, and to families $2,100. Medicaid enrollment in Minnesota is expected to increase 21%. The Medicare actuary talked and continues to talk about his concern that the so-called cost savings in Obamacare will not be realized because Congress will refuse to do the $500 billion cut to Medicare, and they will not cut the reimbursements to doctors. And therefore, he said in one quote, which I don't have with me, but basically, I think he said more true than false, and that was the fact that the costs were not going to go down, that would be more true than false. And then the last thing that I would say is to Representative Murphy and her comment about the tax versus the penalty. It's very interesting to read Judge Hudson's decision, because Judge Hudson in his decision talks at great length about the tax versus a penalty, and notes how the earlier versions of Obamacare had tax written all over them. And then very specifically, it was left out in the bill that actually became law, but all the other taxes had tax, and so it's very clear that they meant it to be a penalty, and that was one of the reasons why he ruled as he did. So those are my comments. We certainly support stopping the funding of Obamacare until this has at least has gotten through the Supreme Court, and even then we would hope that state legislators would stand up as state legislators and under the Fourth Amendment and say no to the federal government telling them how to do their business. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Members, we're trying to be even-handed here. We've given about a half an hour to each bill. If we stick with this, we'd have to wrap up by 4:45. I think we'll have a little leeway here. We have four additional testifiers and a couple of questions from members. Representative Franson and then Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brace, I just have a quick question. Sorry. Romney Care? How effective is that in Massachusetts?
Ms. Brace.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franson, Romney Care, there was recently an article, I believe it was maybe in the Wall Street Journal, talking about the Massachusetts healthcare mess, or maybe it was the Romney Care mess, but it was just talking about how the costs were going high, how the doctors were leaving, how they indeed got more people insured, but they couldn't necessarily give them access to physicians and healthcare because lots of the doctors weren't there or they didn't have time slots available. So the cost is very high. And an interesting thing I think about Romney Care is how recently the president took the opportunity to say, because of Romney Care, how Mitt Romney and he were together on Obamacare in a way to try and mesh Romney Care by a Republican with Obamacare by a Democrat. So,
Representative Franson. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is either to Representative Guthagen or any of the testifiers. And my question is this. What happens if the United States Supreme Court never rules on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act? And with your legislation then in play here in Minnesota, would that bar Minnesota from forever participating in the Affordable Care Act?
Representative Grinhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think I'll let Attorney Kim Crockett. Sounds like a technical issue.
I haven't thought about that. Mr. Chair,
Ms. Crockett, welcome back.
You're right. They could decline to hear the case, though it's unlikely, because when you have a disagreement within the circuits, the district courts and the circuits coming up, there's a lot of pressure on the court to make that decision. So I think that the likelihood of that is probably very low, though I'm sure several of them would love to run and hide under their robes from this one. This will be the biggest decision that I can think of in, you know, decades, if not longer. But thinking it through, then we would be left with a legal quandary. Mm-hmm. And just like we have today, the state of Minnesota has to decide, you as a legislature have to decide, what are your duties as legislators? It's all you can do. You're not the governor. You are the House. And as members of the House, you have a duty to act on the United States and Minnesota constitutions to the best of your ability. And it would be my recommendation to you that you resist what I see as the greatest assault by the federal government on state and individual authority in the history of the United States. And I apologize if that sounds dramatic, but I really do believe it to be an accurate statement.
Representative Grinhagen.
I agree with everything she said.
Representative Fritz.
Well, and I didn't ask that. That went beyond the answer that I was looking for, actually. But I think your first comment to the question suffices. And thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for Ms. Crockett, I have another question. I wanted to quick catch you before you got too far there. My understanding of Judge Vinson's, that he gave the Obama administration 1 week to send this on to an appeal. If the Obama administration does not appeal, my understanding from Judge Vinson is that then his injunction staying the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, that would then be stayed, and his injunction would stand, or is that not the case? My understanding is that if the Obama administration does not appeal, then the injunction would proceed.
Yes.
Ms. Crockett.
Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer. If they do not file an appeal by this Thursday, March 10th, then his injunction, which he did clarify in his order last week, would again prevail.
Okay. And then, Ms. Crockett,
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to if they do appeal, then the court makes a decision, the U.S. Supreme Court makes a decision whether to accept it for consideration or not. But I think that was the answer from Representative Fritz, which had to do with, yes, they do have an opportunity to decline, highly unlikely considering the disagreement between the appeals courts. So I just wanted to clarify that only after March 10th of this week does that next question come about that you spoke to from Representative Fritz. Right?
Ms. Crockett.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, my understanding is that they may still just file what he anticipated they would do at the end of January, which is just a notice of appeal to the injunction he issued on January 31st, I believe, but they also could file for expedited appeal. And he urged all parties involved to do that, but my understanding of it, and I could be wrong, is that they have the option to do either the 11th Circuit at this point, which they're in, or to go for expedited. And I think it's more likely that they would probably stay at the 11th.
Members, just real quickly, I'd like to remind you, we're at 4:45 almost right now. We've got four more testifiers, and we have at least five amendments. So we have a lot to get done yet if we're going to stay on time with this bill. I don't want to cut off legitimate discussion, but we need to kind of stay on track. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know,
I have to say that, you know, this use of the term Obamacare, while, you know, I don't personally mind if the president's name is associated with the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, I fully support the Affordable Care Act, although, like most of us, I don't think the bill is perfect. I don't think the law is perfect. Obviously, no large change is perfect when it's first implemented, and it needs work as it goes on. But I think the use of this term, which we keep hearing here, is really offensive in the way it's used, and it's used in a very partisan way. And, you know,
Representative Liebling, I would have to respectfully disagree as chair of this committee. We've covered this on numerous occasions already. The Associated Press, major newspapers across the country, have all used the term Obamacare pretty much interactively with the official title of this. This is true of things like the Bush tax cuts. Romney Care has been referred to here. There are numerous examples of this being used, and to debate endlessly in committee whether or not it's offensive, I respect people's sensibilities, but I think there is enough common usage in society right now around this to say that either term could be used. I think
Chair,
I mentioned that as chair of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I think I had the floor. I'm sorry. It's quite unusual to be interrupted
Liebling,
in the middle of a statement, but
I was about to
end my statement by simply saying that from now on, I think I will refer to the Iraqi war as the Bush War and say that over and over.
Representative Liebling, you're out of order. That is so off topic.
I'm done, Mr. Chair.
We need to debate on the bill, okay? I don't see any more questions before the committee. We do have additional testifiers. Ms. Crockett, briefly, please.
Mr. Chair, I beg your just a few moments. I apologize. I have the written order right in front of me for Representative Kiffmeyer and the committee. Quote, this is Judge Vincent, after careful consideration of the factors noted above, so on and so forth, I find the motion construed as a motion for stay should be granted. However, the stay will be conditioned upon the defendants, which is the Department of Justice, filing their anticipated appeal within 7 calendar days, which would be March 10th. And here's the important part. Within 7 calendar days of this order and seeking an expedited appellate review either in the Court of Appeals or with the Supreme Court under Rule 11. I apologize if there's any confusion. So
thank
it has
you,
to be expedited, but it can be either court.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. I have Peter Vedenka and Terry McCall signed up to testify. If those people are here and can make their way to the testifying table. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Terry McCall. I live in Burnsville. Just to give you a little moment background, I've got 30 years of experience with 3M Healthcare. I do not speak for 3M, certainly here. I'm retired now. I own a business in Burnsville. My parents were both in the healthcare profession for over 50 years here in the state of Minnesota. The information that's being passed around, I think, is probably the most helpful piece, and I'll try to keep my comments limited here. Obamacare will cost Minnesota taxpaying families too much. Family health care costs will increase dramatically and immediately if the Affordable Health Care Act is worked through here in Minnesota. Out of $105 billion in appropriations for just this year alone, 2011, I'm a pretty simple guy. I can't speak when we start talking about numbers that have 11 zeros behind them. I cannot fully comprehend them, even though I'm in a financial business. If you do the math, what just the increases this year alone will mean to a Minnesota family is over $2,000 in additional cost in taxes and in future debt that we're asking them if we adopt this bill. I can't speak more forcefully than that. Our people cannot afford it in the state. It's immoral to ask our children and our grandchildren to continue to pick up our debt. So again, just for Minnesota, or just for 2011, long before any benefits would be paid by Obamacare, the cost to U.S. taxpaying families is an additional $2,000 a year in health care cost just this year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any quick questions? Yes, Representative Liebling.
Thank you to the testifier. Do you know the cost of the Bush War from the beginning till now?
That's out of order, Representative Liebling. I apologize to the testifier. Can we have our next testifier, please? Is Peter Vedenka here? If he is not, we have two other testifiers who just indicated. Leon Moe. And anybody else who's interested in testifying on this bill, if you could please come up to the testifying area so we know you're ready. I see Ms. Krenke also, and she'll be next. Mr. Moe, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Leon Moe. I live in Cottage Grove. I volunteer for the 10th Amendment Center. I am a combat veteran that still supports the Constitution. When I read the Constitution, it tells me that health care is not a delegated power granted to Congress under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Health care is therefore reserved to the states. I find it disappointing that the people of Minnesota do not have a state legislature willing to stand up and say, no, this is unconstitutional, this is no law at all, and we need to make this null and void in the state of Minnesota. Whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, a nullification of the act is the rightful remedy. Thomas Jefferson. Thank you for the opportunity.
Mr. Moe, thank you for your testimony. Ms. Krenke, welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krenke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm going to start today with one of my favorite quotes from one of my favorite philosophers, which is Yogi Berra. And Yogi Berra said, the hard thing about predictions is they're in the future. And the problem that we're in right now, quite frankly, with the federal health care reform bill is we don't know what is going to stay, what is going to be out, what may be amended, and what the Congress and the current president, as well as potentially the next president, what they may do with this big piece of legislation. So in light of that, Minnesota as a state really needs to act prudently and think about what are the options available to us. And I just specifically would like to mention two things within the federal health care reform bill and how this committee may want to think about these two items. The first one is the federal health insurance exchange, and I know it's been somewhat controversial, but I think it's important for this committee to recognize that if Minnesota does not pass a health insurance exchange law, the way the federal law is written now, we will default to a national health insurance exchange. So I think that we should put all of our creative energy and efforts into coming up with a health insurance exchange bill that we like here in Minnesota, not one that is set by the national standards. Quite frankly, the Minnesota Hospital Association has a couple amendments and suggestions that we would like to make to Representative Gottwald's bill as it stands now. But in terms of the health insurance exchange, if Minnesota does not pass one, it defaults to the federal one if the federal legislation stays in place. The second point that I would like to make is regarding the early Medicaid enrollment program. And I know that that has also been controversial with this committee. But if we undo the early Medicaid enrollment, it will cost the state $54 million. I noticed that there's no fiscal note today on Representative Grunhagen's bill, and at least the last report I saw from the Office of Management and Budget said there would be a $22 million cost for the 10-11 biennium and a $32 million cost for the 12-13 biennium. and we have moved forward with the early Medicaid enrollment. I just want to share that we have covered this population here in Minnesota, either on our Minnesota Care program or on our General Assistance Medical Care program. This is a population that makes less than $8,000 a year. I would like to argue with this, at least make the point, that this state would cover this population on one of our state health care programs, even if we did not have the federal money. We have covered them in the past. I believe we would cover them in the future. So really all we're doing is a two-year window of using the federal money to help us balance our state budget. We see what happens in the future, but in the meantime, we move forward with the early Medicaid enrollment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Krenke. Questions? Ms. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Krenke, you're saying to the next 2 years to use the federal funds, correct, to help us? When those federal funds aren't there anymore, isn't that kicking the can down the road and we're going to be left with a
Ms. Krenke.
Mess?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Franzen, the way the early Medicaid enrollment program is on the books now, and I realize that that is potentially subject to change, the federal government will be paying 100% of the costs of that population starting in October of 2013. So we really just need a two-year program, and then by then we'll know if the federal government is picking up 100% of the costs or have they decided not to do it. The way the program is for the next 2 years, it's a 50-50 partnership. The state pays 50% and the federal government is paying 50%.
Representative Franzen. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Krenke, did the National Hospital Association support the Affordable Care Act?
Ms. Krenke.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the National American Hospital Association did support the federal legislation. It was controversial with a number of the hospitals, both within Minnesota as well as around the country, but it was a decision of the American Hospital Association to support the legislation.
Thank you.
Ms. Krenke, does the American Hospital Association represent all hospitals?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it is a voluntary organization and not all members are members of the American Hospital Association. I will say that the vast majority of them are.
Thank you. Members, we have one other person who's asked to testify. Mr. Clemson, if you could come up. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. It's thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Lyle Clemenson. I live in Brooklyn Park. We lived there since my wife and I have lived there since 1971. Born and raised in Minnesota. Went to school with the Red Lake Indians up there, you know, and then moved elsewhere. Anyway, I've been in business, my present company, for over 30 years. First of all, talking about insurance, we've had almost from the very beginning. First of all, we had self-insured, and then the state and federal government came in and said that we, if you're less than 50 employees, you can't have be self-insured. That went away. So we went ahead and we had other insurance, and then the state and the government came in and said, now you got to have, then the state and the government came in and said, now you got to have pregnancy insurance. And I said, well, that's fine. I mean, we have to watch so that we can make money so we can make the payroll, and we love our employees, and that's the only way we can stay in business with our employees. So then we went ahead and absorbed that, got that. Next, the government came in and said, now you have to have mental health. No choice. Mental health. Then next came we had to have alcohol treatment. And I said, we don't have people. We have alcohol. Why should we have to insure that? And fourth came with drug care. We said, we can't afford this. We can't afford this. And that's what's happening here. I see this as we can't afford. What we have done now in the last many years is our employees, we've asked them to become or get their own coverage, and then we negotiate what we do. And we also have profit sharing in our company, so we have to make money in order to keep our employees. Most of our employees have been with us for many years, and one we just celebrated 16 years. And we want, that's the only way we can stay in business. And I see with this program here, we will be out of business. Thank you very much. Appreciate you listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for being here. Members, I don't see anybody else available to testify or interested in testifying. We have five amendments. And members, in the future, I'm going to ask that in addition to the 24-hour rule, and we will send this around to everybody by email so it's official, but I'm going to ask that names be put on amendments at the same time that they are offered with the 24-hour rule so that we know who's bringing them. All too often, especially as we get later in the session, amendments are tossed around like a deck of cards, and we kind of choose and pick who's going to carry them. It would be nice to know who is carrying them, much like anything else that we hand out in committee. With that kind of precursor, we have the H0468A1 amendment, and I don't have a name on that.
Not being offered.
It's not being offered. Great. Okay, we'll move on to the A2 amendment. And I believe Representative Liebling is offering this.
She's got the A5.
Okay. I actually had you down for A2, A3, and A4, but we can... Is anybody hearing the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair,
I have.
Okay. Representative Huntley.
This says that if this bill passes that... notwithstanding anything in paragraph A, we would still prohibit the denial of insurance coverage for children with pre-existing conditions such as cancer, asthma, diabetes, pneumonia, and other chronic or terminal illnesses. So we would still keep that part of the law with our insurance companies, and I would ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, as I look at this amendment, it's we have an excellent health care program in force and private insurance. We have MCHA to take care of these particular needs. To me, it's just trying to implement part of the Affordable Care Act, and I would urge a no vote on this amendment. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the sincerity with which Representative Huntley brings this amendment. As we try to improve our various health plans, I just want to remind whoever is listening to this today, that we only can influence a small share of the market, that the 25% of the market is currently in fully insured HMOs. We can also affect CGIP, which would carry a fiscal note on this. And so that would actually then take this bill to another committee, at which point, should this become in effect, we'd have to decide what else not to do. And that actually could well come back to this committee as additional target. And so in the name of this good idea, you might find yourself cutting disability services or state employees or some other thing. So I'll make the same comment to the next group. These are fine amendments. And we had a debate on the floor about the tax bill. And there's some people that I thought would have voted yes on the idea of more taxes, and they didn't like that version of it. And so that was called, you know, a project or some other words.
I think the word was juvenile, Representative.
Okay, well, I wasn't going to go there, Mr. Chair. But these are meant to make some point, and by the aggregate, they will make a point. But I do want to remind members that none of these wonderful protections, which I like, are free, and every single one of them adds to the cost drivers in the health system that we are asserting that we want to fix. And you can have anything you want as long as you're willing to pay for it. The question you might ask, if these goes on, how many people will be denied health insurance because they can't afford it? And so when you're voting to put these on, you're actually voting to terminate some people's ability to have health insurance. And as small businesses, you want to ask them, how much will they have to raise the employee payments to cover the cost that these will be having? And so as nice as they sound, I want to caution members, there are two sides to the story. So I vote how you like. But I'm just suggesting that it's not like you care about kids with some issue, or you care about high blood pressure or not, or you care about, I should have my glasses on, early retirees, or you care about dependent coverage, which I have supported that bill. But it's a matter about the whole big thing. And so, I mean, here we are. Let's just vote on these. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my understanding, Representative Abler, is CGIP is offers family coverage, and no one is asked to provide information about the health of their children in getting signing up for family coverage. So I don't want to mislead any state employers or people who belong to group into thinking that this is threatening in any way their family coverage, because that's not how group insurance works. And I really believe, and to Representative Grunhagen's comment about what AMCHA would be a concept available to these families, AMCHA, as you might know, is our high-risk pool. Minnesota was a leader in establishing that so that people who had serious health problems or their children had who had serious health problems could, instead of having to go into bankruptcy and lose their house and all financial security in their life, could get their health conditions taken care of with an insurance product. And that product costs 125%, or can cost up to 125% of the average policy for someone of that age. And so it's a very expensive product for someone, but it is great that we offer it. But we need to think about who pays for that. AMCHA, the funding that supports that, is paid for by our small businesses. The self-insured plans, the big employers do not have to contribute in because they're self-insured and the state can't assess that charge back to them. So the people who are paying for the AMCHA costs of that pool are our smallest businesses who are most struggling in this economy. And here we have an opportunity to help families with a child with severe disabilities, a life-threatening illness, to have access to affordable coverage. And no matter what you think about the rest of the bill, I think we ought to stand up for our families who are trying to do the right thing and trying to make sure that their children have access to care. I really believe insurance is about sharing risk and not avoiding it, and I think this particular one does an excellent job at doing that.
Well, Representative Liebling, I would point out that making promises we can't keep with money we don't have is not doing a favor to our children, and that, in fact, our system right now does do a better job than most states. And we actually have some bills still to come through this legislature. We have a few months left that would do a great job of addressing some of the issues you just raised. Representative Franson.
I'm Liebling. She's Loeffler.
I'm sorry.
My apologies. Representative Loeffler. Representative Franson. Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. When I listen to the debate, I wonder for whom we have a health care system. And if we're saying that we have a health care system, but we're going to be able to block kids with cancer, what kind of system is that? We're going to say that you don't have to cover somebody with a pre-existing condition like cancer, it's the language in the bill. If we have a health care system and it's not meant to care for the people who are sick, but instead we're going to ask somebody else to do it, and we are the state legislature, we represent the people, we the people. If it's not up to us to decide that kids with cancer should get care, I don't know whose job it is.
Representative Murphy, I don't see anything in this amendment or the language that's been proposed in the bill that says we're going to block kids from cancer treatment. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kids with cancer is not trivial. And this amendment and the other amendments are trivial in the fact that they're throwing up a little sound bite, but it's disingenuous not to have a complete activity wrapped around these thoughts, and it really doesn't solve the solution to throw up sound bites for the media as opposed to trying to work on a complete solution. So I would work towards, you know, with the people on the other side of the aisle to try and come up with a solution, because I think Minnesota does a better job than anywhere else in the nation on health care. And part of the problem this bill is trying to address is that the national solution will not be anywhere near the quality, the capability, and the completeness that Minnesota can do. And that's the question. And I will work with people across the aisle to come up with a Minnesota solution. But the question this bill is addressing is trying to avoid a national solution that is not going to be as good as what we've got now, and I think will ruin the wonderful health care and the wonderful work we've done for generations for the people, children, and seniors of Minnesota.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hear the passion in your voice, Representative Quam. And you need to know that I moved to Minnesota in 1988, practiced nursing, and have been working on health policy since then. So I'm not talking about a soundbite. I am talking about chronic problems with the health care delivery system and the payment system in Minnesota and across the country. And when we reach across the aisle and work together, we have to start by defining the problem. And whether we like the Affordable Care Act or not, one of its provisions says to insurance companies, you can no longer deny people coverage because they're sick. Children. You can no longer deny children coverage because they have a pre-existing condition like cancer. We haven't been able to solve that problem in Minnesota. We've patched together a series of things, including the high-risk pool. We've done our best, but there are still people and a growing number of people who don't have coverage, and generally it's the people who are sick that are falling between the cracks. So I don't mean this as a soundbite. I mean this with all seriousness, that we have a problem in Minnesota and we have a problem in America, and if we work together, and I want to work with you, we can figure out a solution, but we shouldn't just reject things because of ideology. And I'm a little bit worried that today's legislation is more about ideology than it is about finding solutions that will actually work, taking the best from all the places. So I want to let you know that I am not trying to pick at you or pick at anybody, but we need to think through how we're going to solve the problem for Minnesota, and we have tools available to us in the Affordable Care Act, and we should use them.
Representative Barrett.
Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to make a comment about that last statement. I don't know so much that it's about ideology with me. I think it's about the fact that we have a $14 trillion national debt. We still have a 9% unemployment rate. We still have many people who aren't getting proper health coverage. We seem to think as a nation that if we throw more money at a problem or a government solution, that problem will, voila, go away. It's never been the case. It never will be the case. And so I see this as another federal government program that, quite frankly, is unconstitutional, and that will not solve the problem that we all so desperately want to solve. It's one thing to throw out a $2,500 health care or a 100-page health care bill. It's another thing to actually solve a problem. And so I'm looking for solutions. I don't think this is it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. There will be a roll call. Is there further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll on the A2 amendment.
Gatwald?
No.
Mack?
No.
Abler?
No.
Barrett?
No.
Benson?
No.
Franzen?
No.
Britz?
Yes.
Grunhagen?
No.
Osh? Huntley?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Loeffler?
Yes.
Lohmer?
No.
McDonald?
No.
McElpatrick?
No.
Moran?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Norton?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
Okay, members, there being 8 ayes and 12 nays, the motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. A3 amendment. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A3 amendment. This simply says that if this bill passes, we will not prohibit... we will still prohibit denial of health insurance coverage based on previous conditions, and we will eliminate lifetime benefit caps. If someone's in a hospice and dying and they reach their lifetime cap, the insurance company quits paying, and then what happens? So, Mr. Chair, I would like a roll call.
Roll call has been requested.
Members, I suspect a very similar discussion is on the last amendment. Representative Grinhagen, then Representative
Kiffin. Yeah, I would just speak to the amendment again. We're looking to attach it to the federal law. I believe we can solve the problems that we have in the state of Minnesota. I think we've done an excellent job addressing them over a period of time. There is a health care cost crisis, not a care crisis, but a cost crisis, which is creating thousands of insured. And that's the problem that we can solve. This federal, Affordable Care Act is not going to solve those problems. It's by transferring billions of dollars into bureaucracy. You're going to get more people on rationing, less care. You're going to have nameless, faceless bureaucrats intervening between the doctor-patient relationship. And to put these types of amendments to that is simply heading us in the wrong direction and ultimately sends the message that you don't have the faith in the Minnesota healthcare industry and those of us here in Minnesota to address the problems that we have. I believe we do, so I strongly support a no vote on the A3 amendment.
Okay, members, there's been a roll call called. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. I have an oral amendment to this bill.
Please state your oral amendment.
To the amendment, sorry.
Kiffmeyer.
Oral amendment to the amendment. My oral amendment would be that immediately in front of the parenthetical B on line 1.4, the words, realizing that this is an unfunded mandate.
Okay, Representative Kiffmeyer moves that on line 1.4 of the A3 amendment, immediately following the quotation mark and before the parenthetical B, the words realizing that this is an unfunded mandate would be inserted. Is that correct, Representative Kiffmeyer?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Mr. Chair. Motion has been made. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on the oral amendment. A
roll call has been requested on Representative Kiffmeyer's oral amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? If not, the clerk will take the roll.
Gowwald.
No. I'm sorry, yes. The amendment. To the amendment, yes.
Yes. Okay, Mack.
Yes.
Abler.
Yes.
Barrett.
Yes.
Benson.
Yes.
Franson.
Yes.
Ritz.
No.
Grunhagen.
Yes.
Hosh. Huntley.
No.
Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Liebling?
No.
Loeffler?
No.
Lohmer?
Yes.
McDonald?
Yes.
McElpatrick?
Yes.
Moran?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Norton?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Quam?
Steve.
There being 12 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails, and the amendment to the amendment is adopted. And so now we have the amended A3 amendment before us. And there is a roll call on the amendment once we get to that. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And none of us knows what's going to happen to us in any lifetime. I happen to know two people who have decades ago had heart transplants, who never thought their life by a sudden infection would take such a turn, and yet they're still working and they're still providing for their families. I know a woman who had a double lung transplant who got 13 wonderful years out of that opportunity that wouldn't have been available if her insurance company hadn't stepped up. And, you know, I don't like to characterize anyone as nameless, fameless, faceless, and uncaring. But I can't imagine a worse job in the world than to be the insurance staff person who has to send someone a letter that says, you hit the limit, I'm sorry about your terminal illness, we're abandoning you. And I don't think that's the purpose of insurance. I once again believe that insurance is about us as a community sharing that risk. I think this is, we've made an insurance industry that has saved lives so that they could be productive, like my friends and coworkers who have gone through some really pretty scary times and emerged successfully. But they would exceed, I'm sure, many lifetime limits if this were to pass.
Well, Representative Loeffler, I would just point out, and I think there can be legitimate disagreement on this issue of who does denying and what isn't delivered and is delivered, but Medicare, for example, has a much higher rate of denial of claims than private insurance. So we could go around and around on that issue and bring up various statistics. Any other discussion to the A3 amendment as amended? If not, there's a roll call on the amendment. I'll have the clerk take the roll.
Gottwald?
No.
Mack?
No.
Abler?
No.
Barrett?
No.
Benson?
No.
Branson?
No.
Ritz?
Yes.
Grunhagen?
No.
Osh? Huntley?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Loeffler?
Yes.
Lohmer?
No.
McDonald?
No.
McElpatrick?
No.
Moran? Murphy?
Yep.
Norton?
Yep.
Peterson?
Yep.
Guam?
Yep.
There being 9 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Okay, we're on to the A4 amendment.
I have that one.
Representative Huntley, your amendment.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, a part of the Accountable Care Law in Washington allows a tax break to companies that supply health care to their retirees prior to the age of 65 when they become eligible for Medicare. And I have handed out this sheet to you, and it lists all the companies in Minnesota that have taken advantage of that, and that includes the state of Minnesota, companies like Elite, which is the big power company in northeastern Minnesota, Anderson Corporation, that's the windows, Blue Cross Blue Shield for their own employees or own retirees, Ceridian Corporation, one of the most advanced companies in the country, City of Duluth, of all things, the Duluth Building Trades, Ecolab, Great River Energy, Land O'Lakes, the Mayo Clinic, Minnesota Teamsters. So if you don't want to get your Teamsters mad at you, I would suggest you vote for this amendment. The Regents of the University of Minnesota have taken advantage of this. The state of Minnesota has taken advantage of this. The state of Minnesota, Minnesota Management and Budget, State Treasurer's Office has taken advantage of this. Super Value, Toro Company, Travelers Companies, XL Energy, they've all taken advantage of this. And for the state to take advantage of it, they have to fill out a form, and that's a state employee. And this bill says that no state money should be spent on doing this. So that would mean that no state employee could fill out the form. No state employee could write a grant to get money that's related to the Affordable Care Act. So I urge you to support this amendment.
Representative Abler. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to do an oral amendment on this amendment.
Please state your oral amendment.
Line 1.4 after the parenthetical B, insert, realizing that this is an unfunded mandate.
Okay, Representative Kiffmeyer moves an oral amendment to the A4 amendment. Immediately after the parenthetical B on line 1.4, we would insert the words, realizing that this is an unfunded mandate. Is that correct, Representative Kiffmeyer?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Good. Representative Huntley.
Well, it's not a mandate. This program is completely voluntary. Unless this bill passes and the state can't do it anymore.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Money doesn't fall from the sky. I don't know if you guys talked about this, these grants that fell from the sky. Was that discussed earlier when I was gone?
That'll be coming up.
Okay, I can't wait. anyway, and all the money comes from somebody. And in this particular situation, it's going to come from some business or somebody else, and it's not just going to come from nobody. And what got us in the position we're in now, and I didn't mean to get on a soapbox, but I've spent the last 4 months, 3 months of my life trying to figure out a way to balance this stuff. And I've come to realize that chasing money like what the next discussion is going to be about, these free grants from Washington, has cost us dearly. And we can't put enough federal money in our budget to make us happy. And when we take a dollar, we get two, and we're excited. We take a dollar and get three, we're out of our minds with enthusiasm for that dollar. And we have become so dependent on designs that are beyond our control that we have got ourselves in just one heck of a spot. And that money, to the point that the feds are $1.6 trillion in debt, and they're making promises to pay for this stuff with money they do not have, with they have no plan to have any money for it, and we're doing them a favor if we get them off the hook for some of these things, and to take on that duty ourselves is just asking for more trouble. And so these are wonderful provisions. We all wish we could have these and afford them for everybody. But I'm telling you, it's not prudent to build promises, to make promises you cannot have any way to keep. I didn't tell my son I'd be home early tonight. Lucky, because I'm not going to be able to keep that promise to him, because we're talking about this important work. But please don't have anybody believe for a minute that these are service, that these benefits are going to come to somebody for no cost to somebody else, and that there's no impact on the private sector or the state sector or the federal sector some way to have these good things happen. And I'll stop. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would also point out, Representative Huntley, the word on line 1.4 is must, which sounds like a mandate to me. Seeing no further discussion to the amendment, I'm sorry, Representative Liebling.
There is we're on the oral amendment, I believe, and I'd like a roll call on that.
Roll call has been requested on Representative Kiffmeyer's oral amendment to the A4 amendment. A roll call having been requested, any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Got Welch.
Yes.
Mack.
Yes.
Abler.
Yes.
Barrett.
Yes.
Benson.
Yes.
Ranson.
No. Oh, I mean, yes. I'm so sorry.
It's all right. It was a trick question. No.
Well, at least I was bipartisan, right?
You're in time. You're in time.
Fritz.
No.
Runehagen?
Yes.
Hosh? Huntley?
No.
Kiffmeyer?
Yes.
Liebling?
No.
Loeffler?
No.
Lohmer?
Yes.
McDonald?
Yes.
McElpatrick?
Yes.
Moran?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Norton?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Huam?
Oui.
Okay, there being 12 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So we now have the A4 amendment before us as amended. Further discussion, roll call has been called. The clerk will take the roll on the A4 amendment as amended.
Got Walt?
No.
Mac?
No.
Abler?
No.
Garrett?
No.
Benson?
No.
Ranson?
No.
Fritz?
Yes.
Runehagen?
No.
Hosh? Huntley?
Yes.
Kiffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Loeffler?
Yes.
Lohmer?
No.
McDonald?
No.
McElpatrick?
No.
Moran?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Norton? Peterson?
Yes.
Guam?
There being 8 ayes and 12 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. We're on to the A5 amendment. I think, Representative Huntley, you mentioned that's yours as well.
No, that one's...
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, obviously we're on a theme here, and this has to do with the extension of dependent coverage to the age of 26, which is something that among my constituents is very, very popular. As we know, young people under the age of 26 are actually very cheap to cover, relatively speaking, and they often have no insurance because oftentimes they graduate from college, maybe they have that first job, they have a job that doesn't offer them coverage. And so this has been a very popular provision of the Affordable Care Act, and one that certainly my constituents, many of them are interested in it and benefiting from it. So certainly if we were, this is a very popular provision and one that I would not want to repeal, certainly, and I think many of my constituents would not want to repeal. Now, if we're going to talk about, you know, the costs, and, you know, clearly you can't, nothing is free, and we can't give people health coverage without paying for it. That's certainly clear. And I think that Representative Murphy said before, the point of insurance is to spread the risk. It's very important to get this relatively low-risk group covered. Also, I appreciate, Representative Grunhagen, that you are trying to use the appropriate word for the federal law. I really do appreciate that. But I had gotten some information since I last spoke and found out that the Iraq War has cost Minnesota over $18 billion.
Representative Liebling, we're off topic once again.
No, Mr. Chair, we're not.
Representative Liebling, we are talking about a health care bill in a health care policy committee. We are not talking about the cost of the Iraq War in this committee. I'm sorry.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Liebling, I'm asking you to cease. I am the chairman of this committee, and I've already spoken on this twice before.
I have an election.
The cost of the Iraq War is not a topic for this committee. Please cease.
We are talking about costs, Mr. Chair.
You can talk about health care costs, not the Iraqi war costs.
Well, if you don't want the $18 billion to be mentioned, so be it, Mr. Chair. But I am moving,
Mr. Chair.
I am moving this amendment.
Mr. Chair. It was
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was okay to talk about the national deficit, which is not a health care issue. So I think we should allow Representative Liebling.
Representative Murphy, the comment was to the Iraq War costs. To my knowledge, this committee has no jurisdiction on the Iraq War whatsoever.
Well, Mr. Chair, may I continue?
You may continue if you're going to talk about the amendment and in terms of Health and Human Services financing, yes.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that I have First Amendment rights, and I am a member of this body, and I hold an election certificate. We are having a broad-ranging discussion here, and I resent being censored in what I'm able to talk about. We're talking about costs the federal government incurs and whether those costs are sustainable. So, Mr. Chair, I think it's entirely on topic and appropriate. But your interrupting me and trying to talk over me merely prolongs the discussion on this topic, and I was just simply going to give that number, which I think is very important and appropriate to put all of this in perspective. That is just the cost to Minnesota over the 10 years since the war started, $18 billion. And I would submit, Mr. Chair, that we didn't buy insurance or health care for our citizens with that money. So we need to put things in perspective. And, of course, we're still spending money on that war. But anyway, so this is my amendment, is to continue coverage for those up to age 26, even if we were to pass Representative Grunhagen's bill, and if it was to be signed into law, that we would still provide this very important coverage for young people who ought to be covered. And I also would ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Kiffmeyer and then Representative Franson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to do an oral amendment on line 1.4 after the parenthetical B.
Yep, state your oral amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The oral amendment is after the parenthetical B's, inserting, realizing that this is an unfunded mandate.
Okay, Representative Kiffmeyer, if I understand your amendment correctly, this is an amendment, oral amendment to the A5 amendment on line 1.4 after the parenthetical B. We would insert the word realizing that this is an unfunded mandate. Is correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Very good.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call.
And Representative Liebling has requested a roll call on the amendment to the A5 amendment. Discussion? Representative Barrett?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to inform the committee here that I'm reading a good book right now. It's by Bob Woodward. It's called Obama's Wars. Might want to check it out if you'd like to.
Members, my point, and I'll make this fairly and nonpartisanly, is this committee this committee is about health and human services, and I'll leave it at that. Representative Barrett.
I apologize, Mr. Chair.
Hearing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll on the oral amendment to the A5 amendment.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Mack.
Yes.
Abler.
Yes.
Barrett.
Yes.
Benson.
Yes.
Franzen.
Yes.
Fritz.
No.
Grunhagen.
Yes.
Osh. Huntley.
No.
Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Lohmer.
Yes.
McDonald.
Aye.
McElpatrick.
Yes.
Moran.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Peterson.
No.
Quam.
Aye, aye.
Members, you cannot vote twice in this committee.
Me, certainly can.
Sorry, Representative Quam. Okay. Members, there being 12 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does prevail and the amendment is adopted. So we now have the A5 amendment as amended before us. Further discussion to the amendment as amended? If not, there's been a roll call called on this amendment, and the clerk will take the roll.
Gottwald?
No.
Mack?
No.
Abler?
No.
Barrett?
No.
Edinson?
No.
Franzen?
No.
Fritz?
Yes.
Grunhagen?
No.
Hosh? Huntley?
Yes.
Kiffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Loeffler?
Yes.
Lohmer?
No.
McDonald?
No.
McElpatrick?
No.
Moran? Murphy?
Yep.
Norton?
Yep.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
No.
Okay, there being 8 ayes and 12 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Members, we are on the bill. Further discussion to the bill. Representative Grunhagen, anything to wrap things up?
I just want to reiterate, I realize people of goodwill can disagree on this, okay? I understand that we've had a spirited and at times pointed debate, and there's strong passions associated with it. But the more we can sift through those and get to the actual facts of the bill and its cost, the better we will all be, regardless of what party affiliation that we come from, and I think that does a service to the citizens of the state of Minnesota. I do have just a summary comment here on the bill that I'd like to read briefly. Finally, representatives, it is important to understand the philosophical basis of this law and why we all in the past have sat around this committee, whether we are for or against the Affordable Care Act, and we believe our position is constitutional. What we see here are two views of the Constitution colliding. What I mean by that is that the development of law in the U.S. was originally based on William Blackstone's commentaries. These commentaries taught principles and doctrines that were immutable and unchanging. All law students had to learn was how to apply these principles and doctrines. In other words, the Constitution had fixed and absolute principles of natural law established by the Creator. Our founding fathers provided a way to change the Constitution by amendment. It is a difficult process requiring Congress to pass the amendment and then two-thirds of the state to ratify the amendments. In contrast, the present-day view of law in the Constitution is called sociological law, which believes that the Constitution is a so-called living document and can be changed by judicial decree and case law. This view rejects the idea of a creator and natural law. Under this view, the Constitution becomes whatever a judge or group of judges declares it to be on a given day. Originators of this view of the Constitution and law were the Dean of Harvard Law School, Christopher Langle, during the 1870s, and later Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who served on the Supreme Court from 1902 to 1932. Also, many of our current judges and Supreme Court justices believe in sociological law as it applies to our U.S. Constitution. It has become the predominant view in our law schools today. These two views are at the root of the lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act in relationship to the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, which I'll read at this point. The powers delegated to the United States of the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. For a federal law to mandate that we have to buy a product and impose a penalty if we don't is clearly unconstitutional, even if you're not a judge or a lawyer, on the plain reading of the Constitution. And an excellent book on this subject is Power Divided is Power Checked. Your vote today will indicate whether you primarily hold to the view of a creator and absolutes rooted in natural law found in the Declaration of Independence and the preamble of the Constitution, which testify against the Affordable Care Act, or you believe in sociological law, which rejects a creator and natural law and replaces the creator with judges who become our king and nobility, accountable only to themselves. These judges read rights into the Constitution that are clearly not there. One of these views will lead to liberty, freedom, and prosperity. The other view will eventually strip us of our freedoms, liberties, and prosperity and end in servitude to the state. Thank you for your time and consideration on this bill. I urge a yes vote on the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grinhagen. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I think you ought to read the bill. It says state funds must not be expended in the planning or implementation of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Or implementation. And that means paying somebody's salary. I can tell you that the early enrollment, which brings about $1 billion into our health care providers in the state, it's contingent upon us writing good reports. Even though it's already been awarded, the money's not all here yet, and if we prevent our employees from participating in that program, we will lose that money from the feds. Representative Davids has a bill on the House floor getting the tax code into compliance with the federal law. That would be prohibited by the Grinhagen bill. I passed out a sheet here. This came to us Friday from Office of Management and Budget, and the first item in it is money from a accountable care law in Washington coming to the state of Minnesota. For a net, it's $21 million in fiscal year 2012. In 2013, it's $24 million. It's a total over about 5 years of $180 million. Even though it's been awarded and accepted, we cannot accept that money. We will have to send it all back to Washington because our employees can't fill out the forms. They can't put a postage stamp on that thing telling the feds what we're doing. They cannot apply for any further grants. This would prevent us from implementing your exchange bill because that would take state employees to do something. And we already have a $1 million grant from the feds on the exchange. I suppose we'll have to send that money back as well. So I urge you to vote against this bill.
Mr. Representative Chair. Abler.
Oh, go ahead. Thanks. And, you know, I just have to react a little bit. When it's just interesting what different emotions and feelings you get when you read a list of projects. I got Mr. Showalter, the Commerce or the Finance Commissioner, sent this memo out. I actually read all 80 pages of the memo.
which proves I have no life. And I, the more I read, the angrier I got. And I thought, I couldn't figure out why I was so angry about this when I was reading all these awards we had gotten. And then I realized I knew why I was so unhappy. In Washington, they're arguing about cutting the Pentagon. They're talking about cutting community action grants, even from the president himself, which I'm like, I can't think of a more valuable grant. And that's not meant to bash the president. But I just like, really, they're talking about that. They're talking about all kinds of things they're not going to do. And they can send us money to map ash trees. And Representative Huntley, I'm sure you're happy that they're going to be checking out the beaches where you frequent up in Duluth for E. coli for a couple $100,000. And I'm sitting there working on my budget, trying to find a way to keep the most essential and important and valuable needs of people who are at, in harm's way. Because we have grown a limb that the services we have offered them, we should have known we couldn't be making these promises. And you know I'm wrestling with this. And we're going to spend, I mean, I'm not going to burden you to go through all this stuff. This is not any kind of show. I'm just, you know, this is, I don't know the total of all these other non-DHS ones here. But we're going to grow forests for water. I mean, that seems like a nice idea. You know, I mean, who could be against that? But $250,000, I'll tell you the people who are against that. The people that were here last week, 60 witnesses saying, how can you do that to my chemical dependency program? How can you do that for my living program where my person I love might actually die? And we're accepting every penny we can get from people who think this stuff falls out of the sky. And members, I am told that as the chair, I have the authority to object to a grant and it wouldn't come. I believe that to be true. And I considered it. And out of regard for my lack of knowledge about the one we're getting, this $21 million one we're so proud of, I did not do that. I'm not convinced it's going to do any good at all. I'm more convinced we're going to set up some wonderful programs and do some busy work and spend $21 million and not leverage what we could out of our group, out of the people who already do these services. I ask questions like that. I try to be polite. But we cannot. We spend money like it doesn't matter anything. And so I'm not convinced this is a big asset, Representative Huntley. And it's nice to have, but it's more money to be less efficient and less focused on how we deliver our services. And I had to say that. But I wanted you to know that I didn't turn the money down. And I thought out of respect to the department and the work I hadn't done to know if it was that good or not. But I think in the future, we got to watch this stuff. And every state can't get enough of this free money. And because of that, we're $1.6 trillion in deficit. And, you know, the horror thing. And, I mean, we're spending lots of money on stuff. And we've had to push it offline and shift. And there's $50 million of shifts this committee has to pay for because the decision was made in 2010. $50 million in my target, which I don't even know exactly what it is that I'm still cringing at. So, I mean, members, just remember, a dollar is a dollar, and it comes out of somewhere. And I'll stop. You can just tell I'm upset about it. But it's not about anybody here. It's just the whole system. And we have, and I don't know. So good luck to us.
Mr. Chair, final comment.
Representative Gernhagen, then Representative Murphy.
Oh, if we do lose that money, we could send it back to Washington. Hopefully they'll send it back to China and pay their debt down that we owe them. We need to quit bankrupting our children and grandchildren's future. This has to stop. And it needs to stop now. Borrowing and mortgaging our grandchildren and children's future will not do good things for their health care or our own. And so, again, I empathize, I understand where you're coming from, but the law of good intentions can lead us into total bankruptcy and the eliminating the value of our monetary system. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a couple of comments. First of all, I want to be clear, and I would bet that most people at the table don't consider the money that's coming free money. We all know where that money's coming from. It's coming from Americans, right? And it's coming from Minnesotans who are paying their taxes. They pay more into Washington than they get back, right? But we get that it's not free money. We have a disagreement about, you know, the value of moving forward with the Affordable Care Act, and I think reasonable people can disagree, just like Representative Gruenhagen said. But And we're also talking about the federal deficit, which I think is really interesting, and we could talk all day long and all night long about the reasons why there's a big deficit and who's at fault. But I don't think that's going to help us either. We have a growing number of people in Minnesota without insurance, and we have a number of people who are sick who can't get care. And from my perspective, that's what we should be thinking about how to fix. And I don't think yet we have fixed that problem, right? But we know there are side effects. We know the broken healthcare system, both the delivery system and the insurance system, causes job lock for people. So they can't move from one job to another. They get stuck because they need their insurance. It causes job loss because employers say, I can't hire more people because the cost of insurance is going up, so I want to keep the rest of the people insured. It causes cost shifts, right? So that when we have people who are uninsured and they show up in a hospital, those costs get passed on to everybody else. So everybody's health insurance goes up. It causes bankruptcy for people. We're talking about federal bankruptcy. Well, let's think about the individuals who are bankrupt because they have a serious health problem and they can no longer afford to make the payments. They sell their house or, you know, double mortgage their house so they can pay for their sick family member. They go bankrupt. It causes business failure, right? Because they can't afford to, and they take on too much risk for their employees, and their business fails. It costs sick people being denied care, and that's the part that bugs me the most. It's the part that bugs me the most. So I know today isn't about everybody's good ideas about how to solve the problem, but I've been working at this in Minnesota for a long time, and we haven't solved these chronic problems yet, not for lack of effort. They're difficult problems to solve. So I'm going to vote, you know, against your bill today, Representative Grunhagen, probably not a surprise to you, because I think there are opportunities in the federal law. And I think we should take advantage of them because we haven't been able to solve them state by state. There are some things that are better done across the country, and I think this is one of them. But I thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you.
I'm Representative Huntley, Representative Liebling, and Representative Barrett. And members, we are at 10 minutes to 6. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask for a roll call on the bill.
Roll call has been requested on the bill. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to say then, if Americans follow the example of our federal government, and by that I mean going into a tremendous amount of debt that we can't afford, they would be able to pay for their own health insurance. So I don't think we're asking our Americans to do that because it would be unwise. And so with that, I support tremendously this bill. I appreciate Representative Grunhagen bringing it forward, and I would hope that it would pass.
Members, I think we've had a lot of good discussion around this bill, and seeing no further discussion, Representative Grunhagen renews his motion that House File 468 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. There is a roll call on the vote, and I'll ask the clerk to take the roll.
Gottwald.
Aye.
Mack.
Yes.
Abler.
Yes.
Barrett.
Yes.
Benson.
Yes.
Franson.
Yes.
Ritz.
No.
Grunhagen.
Yes.
Osh. Huntley.
No.
Giffmeyer.
Yes.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Lohmer.
Yes.
McDonald.
Yes.
McElfetrick.
Yes.
Moran.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Peterson?
No.
Quam?
Yes. There being 12 ayes and 8 nays, the bill is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Please withhold your applause. Members, there be no other business before the committee. We stand adjourned.